Members will call this meeting of the Education Finance Committee to order. The first order of business is the approval of the minutes dated March 16th. Representative Erickson moves approval of those minutes. Is there any discussion, corrections, changes, or additions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, the first item on our agenda for today is House File 1078. The chair will move House File 1078 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Mr. Crow or Mr. Strom, if you could please cover the bill and the... Do we have the fiscal note or a preliminary draft of it?
Mr. Chair and members, there isn't a fiscal note on the current bill at this time. It hasn't been completed. For reference, the Governor Pawlenty had recommended this, a similar change in 2009, converting the school to the Purpose Center to a charter school. And at that time, there were a couple things that happened in the budget recommendation. One is their savings from currently, the Purpose School is funded as a state agency with a direct appropriation, similar to a state agency, and the students are not funded on a per pupil basis. And I'm sure the folks from the Purpose School talk specifically about what they do, but they have an arts high school. They also have an outreach curriculum development kind of function that is funded out of that appropriation as well as the high school. And so what happens if the school is converted to a charter school on the fiscal side is that the direct appropriation is removed, and so that money would be saved, but then those students would enter, for the most part, the assumption was that all the students would enter the funding system in our per pupil formulas, whether they stayed at a arts charter school or whether they return to their resident district and were served there, but that they would generate per pupil aid in some way. And then if the school was converted to a charter school, it would qualify for charter lease aid, so that would be a line item cost. And for the first 2 years of its operation after the conversion would qualify for charter school startup aid. And then the other cost item related to that is that the Purpich Center employees are currently state employees, and so there are severance costs associated with closing down the Purpich School as a direct-funded state agency and creating a charter school. And so all of those things combined, the direct appropriation for the Purpich School is about $7 million. The costs associated with continuing to fund the students and paying the severance costs totaled in the first year about $4.7 million. So about five of the $7 million of savings was eaten up with additional costs. On an ongoing basis, there was about $2.5 million of ongoing costs for the students, the lease aid, and the startup costs, and so there were those costs would continue over time and be balanced against that elimination of that $7 million direct appropriation for the Purpich School.
Thank you very much, Mr. Crow. So what we have, members, what we're going to do here is we're going to give a 40-minute presentation by the Purpich Center for the Arts, and thank you very much for coming down to testify. And I'm going to allow you guys to police your own time, so we'll be going till about, looks like one, just short of 1:25, but I'm not going to cut you guys off. I'm going to let you handle your own time, so if you feel a tug on the back of your coat or your shirt, it's probably... when your colleague's saying to tighten it up a little bit, but we'll plan on going until, like I said, about 1:25 there. So welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the Education Finance Committee. My name is Sue Mackert, and I have the pleasure of serving as Executive Director of the Perfect Center for Arts Education. I won't take our 40 minutes to introduce speakers, but I will just let you know that you have a list of speakers, and they will be providing some information for you. First and foremost, I do want you to know that we all understand the burden that you feel in terms of cost reduction. And obviously, we're here to let you know the vital importance of the Perfect Center. And it is true, as was just mentioned, that 2 years ago, former Governor Tim Pawlenty did recommend spinning the Perfect Center off as a charter school for budgetary savings. After listening to stakeholders and evaluating the Perfect Center's full impact on students, teachers, and schools in rural and urban Minnesota, the governor and the legislature concluded that the Perfect Center for Arts Education is a vital piece to the state's K-12 education system. It's much more than a school. True, we are a state agency, a very unique state agency in that 100% of what we do is education service to Minnesota's K-12 schools. We're a hub of innovation whose divisions are integrated to provide quality programs and develop best practices for teachers, students, and administrators in communities throughout rural Minnesota. We're the think tank, the incubator, the laboratory. We have three primary divisions: professional development and rural outreach, the arts high school, and a statewide library. All are completely integrated into a single purpose of improving education in and through the arts, and they truly cannot be separated. House File 1078 will eliminate all aspects of the Perfect Center for Arts Education. The bill eliminates all statewide professional development, programming, and technical support. The bill eliminates the only remaining statewide K-12 education library. The bill eliminates rural access to the arts high school. The bill eliminates access to higher education in the arts for rural students whose ability to obtain scholarships and admission is directly related to the Perfect Center for Arts Education's reputation for excellence. The bill eliminates the arts high school, effective June 30, 2011. The bill does make assumptions that an arts-focused charter school could be established, but the arts high school does not meet the legal parameters or conditions of a charter school. We very much respect charter schools and know that they were developed as community-based organizations to handle local needs. The arts high school is statewide, and we would lose rural access as well as our residential component. The arts high school does not meet the legal admission requirements of a charter school. We do not enroll all students, nor do we give preference to those living closest to the school, wherever that would end up. Our board must represent the state, as well as higher ed and business and other entities, in order to successfully incorporate arts education. And it's unrealistic to think that the arts high school could continue to offer six vibrant art areas as a charter school. A charter school could form, but it would not be the arts high school as we know it today. Let me show you a little bit of what will happen if House File 1078 is furthered. I'll do this quickly. What you see in front of you, this is the impact. These are the communities in the state that are served by professional development and outreach programs of the Perfect Center. The second chart shows these student communities, our arts high school students, and where they come from. And the third chart shows effectively what would happen in a charter school only proposal, that really you'd concentrate in the metro area, most likely, and that's what would remain primarily around Pasadena County. So yes, we feel quite strongly about the the loss of all entities of the Perfect Center for Arts Education with House File 1078. The interdependence of all of the segments of the Perfect Center and the loss of the rural component of the Arts High School will be eliminated, rendering the school with a fully different mission and outcome. Example, the Arts High represents Minnesota. We're a think tank for researching and addressing the systemic issues that affect academic achievement. We have very high standards, 100% graduation, 100% college placement for those students going on to college, including all of those in special ed or on IEPs. We also amassed $4.5 million generally in minimum in scholarship offers for our students, and we would lose that. We have an organization in Boston focused on the integration of science and art, and they want to work with us. They want to work with the Arts High School, not just because of the Arts High School, but because of our full organizational structure. The idea that we have the professional development, the connection to the high school, and research all in one component along with a resource library. We don't want to lose that opportunity. We have a rural student right now who's a finalist for a full ride academic scholarship to the Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago. It's an extremely competitive school. The scholarship over 4 years is valued at over $120,000. She will be studying biomedical engineering, and she came to Purpage to be the most creative scientist ever. So the relationship back to the organization in Boston is all part of what makes us nationally recognized for all of the programs that segment. Last month, the College Board, which really, for those of us that took the ACTs and SATs a little time ago, we know that the College Board is really the organization for accountability and assessment. They bestowed upon Purpage an inaugural award for exemplary integrated programming in arts education, because they've been doing research and they've concluded that programs that incorporate arts education have a net positive effect on student achievement. We were very proud of the award. North Central Accreditation, when they visited the campus and saw the full entity of the school and other aspects of Purpage, said, we've never seen such close relationships between teachers and students who want to be there because they are learning. Purpage represents such an effective model for teaching that works. These integrated programs as a full center also enable us to successfully teach all students, be they homeless, be they homeschooled, be they with all different religious and ethnic backgrounds, economic diversity, rural, urban, national merit scholars, autistic, national art scholar winners, that the research component allows us to be successful, which is why students in the Arts High School go on to school. And we always have comments from parents who say, we never expected our son or daughter to be able to succeed, graduate from high school, and go on to college. House File 1078 will close the Arts High School. House File 1078 removes critical direct services for educators throughout the state, particularly rural Minnesota. For example, the 56 dance education teachers that impact over 19,000 students that we're working with are in schools such as Anoka Hennepin, Stillwater, Esco, Rockford, Forest Lake, Mora, and Foley. The 49 media arts teachers that impact 17,000 students that we are currently working with are in schools in Bemidji, Anoka, Buffalo, Rockford, Elk River, Pine River, Bacchus, Annandale, Fridley, Holdingford, Little Falls, and McRae, which is Maynard, Clara City, and Raymond. These are just some of the schools. The 54 theater teachers that are impacting over 19,000 students in their schools are in such schools as Montevideo, Thief River Falls, Wayzata, St. Louis County Schools, and White Earth. We serve 71 teachers and 22 arts organizations in integration and multicultural activities, including students who are in school in Cottonwood, Edina, Eden Prairie, Moundsview, Dawson, St. Cloud, Blaine, and the Ying Howell Academy. Over 285 partner school teachers who impact 20,000 students are also included in communities such as Albert Lea and Westbrook Walnut Grove. Teachers of 648,000 students in rural and in urban communities throughout Minnesota are part of our comprehensive arts planning program. We think successful education comes when you have a plan, a strategic plan. And I can recall when a teacher recently called to say that she had gotten a corporate grant because she was one of our schools in this partner program, and they were so impressed with the fact that a school would have an effective strategic plan. 123 teachers who directly impact 24,000 students are learning innovative teaching methods through our curriculum mapping program, and they're in schools such as Chaska, Rochester, and Worthington. We would lose the ability to also provide the daily professional and technical support. Since the school year, that includes about 34 school districts on an ongoing basis. So the question you would ask, that's a very fair question that we ask ourselves continuously, is, are these programs making a difference? Are they working? We use external research to measure our success, and those of you that are in business know that there's nothing more humbling than an external research that tells you exactly how you're doing. But let me share some results. Our quality teaching in the arts program has been extremely successful. 80% of teachers reported high level of positive impact on professional growth, curriculum development, student assessment, leadership skills, lesson planning, teaching skills, student feedback, and impact in their school districts. We are breaking paradigms. 80% of those teachers reported that they are more or much more able to collect strong evidence of student learning as a result of their participation in PERPICH programs. So we are addressing the systemic issues that affect achievement. 80% of the teachers feel they are more able to differentiate between levels of quality in student work. We are changing teachers. I think of a teacher recently who, a social studies teacher who was doing an art program with our help, and she said that her students, she was amazed at how adept her students were, how tremendously talented they were, and how students who normally get A's because they can memorize and they can handle sequential were having to, they were struggling a bit as to how to perform, whereas those who are more creative thinkers were excelling. Changing teaching and teaching methods. At least 80% of the teachers reported that the following student impacts were a result of their PERPICH participation. Students better understand expectations. Students better understand criteria for grading. Students better understand learning goals. Students can better self-assess. We are engaging students. External research conducted on another PERPICH program illustrates that students were clearly able to articulate what they learned, such as new skills, new process, or understanding. They also provided information of what made this new instruction so engaging and meaningful to them. We're benchmarking best practices. Other external research indicated that teachers said that we were the needed catalyst for reconsidering classroom issues and improving instruction. That's accountability. Teachers said that assessment tool activities helped them clarify educational goals, not only for themselves but for their students. We consider that part of outcomes. Teachers were observably excited by the possibilities of generating other tools of assessment and sharing them. That's changed. 78% respondents in an external survey reported that Purpose Center programs were more effective than other professional development programs they have accessed elsewhere. 88% of respondents cited our professionalism and staff expertise as the strongest attributes. Conclusions of Quadrant Research CEO Bob Morrison, who his vitae is much longer than our 40 minutes, and who has been researching educational effectiveness for decades, reviewed the Purpose Center's research and trends in the state of Minnesota, as he's working with a number of states who are trying to infuse much more arts education into their programs. He said, the Purpose Center for Arts Education is providing quality programs delivered by quality staff, providing measurable impact on participants and their students to serve the needs of the educators and school districts in the state. He said he has never seen such high numbers and can't advise us on how to improve because we can't get much better than the 80 to 95% that teachers say is really good. Rather, he said, our challenge is we're caught in the triangle. And if you see the triangle over here, this is the triangle. School districts are facing shrinking budgets, and there's greater demand for quality programs. And that all feeds up to the Purpose Center. And that's what this consultant has clearly stated, and we've known that too as we've continued to shift our responsibilities. So achievement gaps, together with declining or elimination of art programs in schools, have generated much greater demand today for services of the Purpose Center than in any other time in our history. 88% of school districts, representing 91% of the state's student population, have indicated a desire for added support from the Purpose Center. Those figures are from a survey conducted by the Minnesota Department of Education. Last year, the arts high faculty and members of professional development had capacity to serve 85 of Minnesota's 342 school districts, reaching 13,000 teachers responsible for 220,000 students, give or take a few. We leveraged our expertise and delivered these services at a cost of about $1.36 per student, which I consider a pretty darn good return on investment. The professional development and outreach programs, reaching systemic issues affecting achievement, breaking paradigms in the delivery of education, holding educators accountable for results, would all disappear if the Purpose Center for Arts Education were eliminated. And that concludes my remarks. And I know that there's just really no better source than customers who use our product to be able to speak. So I would like to turn the program over now to Roanne, who will introduce herself and tell you a bit about herself.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Roanne Elliott, and I am the Director of Curriculum Instruction for the Mountain View School District. I have some very brief remarks for you based on my perspective as a school administrator who has used the resources from the Purpose Center over a period of years, and those resources have been critical for us. And there are two points that I'd like to make. One has to do with the fact that the Purpose Center has provided high-quality professional development, and I'm speaking first person here because I've been involved in that as a school administrator with the teachers of the arts in Mounds View Schools. And we started work in the early days of standards, and I don't know if you will remember this, but I remember very well that there was a time in our state at the beginning of standards when we were not sure, many educators were not sure that you actually could have arts education standards and that you actually could assess students' performance against standards. And when we turned to the Purpose Center, who was doing work in this area, it was critical for us that they were able to help us in their development of the work around standards and assessment to understand just how to do that in a most authentic way. And so that was just very critical learning for us in Moundsview. And I have to say that the work that we are currently doing as we continue to review our programs and develop our programs, that it stems back to that early work with standards and assessment through the Perkins Center. The work that went on there spoke directly to arts teachers, because when they were afraid that their work was going to turn into meaningless testing, they learned through Perkins Center programs that no, there are many authentic ways to do a job of integrity around assessment of student work and student performance. That was very important to us, and it continues to be important to us. Second thing I would like to mention is that as we look at our what we're trying to do around STEM in our district, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, we've been working on that in Moundsview for several years, as in many other school districts, and we are at a point where we're developing a program in the middle schools that we want a STEM program, but we're going to develop a program that we're calling STEAM. We're adding the A, because the A is that infusion of the arts, and we don't do that lightly. We're doing that based on lots of research, and we're doing that based on the work of very important people in the arts and in the sciences that are looking at the fact that when you take a narrow view of STEM, you really are doing students a disservice. Is that engineers and people that are working in the sciences are creative individuals. One of the things that we learned through our work with the Perkins Center is that creativity can be taught. You can teach people creative problem solving, and you can assess their ability to solve problems creatively. So as we look forward to developing this program that will be a broader look at STEM, that will include the arts, that will include a strong strand of creativity, and that we expect to make science and math accessible to a broader range of students, not just those students who see themselves already as science and math kids. We need all of our students to see themselves as having those kinds of abilities. And we believe that through STEAM and working with experts at the Perkins Center, we'll be able to do that. One of the things that has been, over the years, that's been wonderful in working with Perkins is that we have a certain amount of confidence in the work that they do, because they are doing it. They're actually doing the work. So we're not just turning to groups that are experimenting. They really know what they're doing, and that's been very important to us. It's been important to our staff, and it's been important to our parents, that they know, that people in our community know, that we have a high-quality resource to turn to. So as we develop our program, yes, we'll be going to the STEM Education Center at the University of Minnesota. Yes, we'll be going to the Science Museum. And yes, we really need to go to Perpich to help with the development of this new program. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Andrew Ellingson, and I teach elementary music in the Eastern Carver County Schools at Clover Ridge Elementary in Chaska, Minnesota. I grew up in Blue Earth, Minnesota, a town of 4,000 in Faribault County. My parents are both music teachers. My mom teaches elementary and middle school band, and my dad teaches middle school and high school choir. When I was a child, the State Department of Education provided professional development to music teachers. I've heard my parents talk about the high-quality information and guidance provided by David Price and Susan Vaughn when they used to come out and work with districts around the state. This kind of professional development to Minnesota's music educators is no longer provided by the Department of Education. Rather, that work has been taken on by the Perpich Center for Arts Education. I currently teach at Clover Ridge Elementary. Over the past 4 years, I've been fortunate enough to work with Nissa Brown, the music education coordinator at the Perpich Center. In addition to going to the Perpich Center for classes, meetings, and to visit the library, our school district has invited Ms. Brown to come and work with our music teachers. These visits and the incredible knowledge and guidance provided by Ms. Brown is a service offered to all Minnesota school districts by the Perpich Center. The schools of Eastern Carver County simply do not have the budget to cover the cost of this type of professional development. Under her guidance, our team of elementary music teachers has completely overhauled our kindergarten through second grade music curriculum. Working within the framework of the newly revised state standards for music education, we have taken the best practices already being used by teachers in our district and shared them with each other. We have crafted common assessments that are directly tied to the standards, and we have revised our report cards. The report cards in our district used to be very generic, reporting on students' performance skills and literacy skills. Now, each of the common assessments is reported out on the report card, making the report card a tool for communicating with parents about whether or not their child is meeting grade level standards that are aligned with the state's expectations. Without the guidance of Ms. Brown and the support of the perpetrator, our team would not have been able to craft a document of the same high quality that we have put in place. We are in the first year of implementing the kindergarten through second grade curriculum, and we plan to revise our curriculum for grades 3 through 5 in the next year. The impact on my teaching and on my students' learning has been huge. Gone are the days when things were included in a music lesson just for fun.
Is there someone touching their mic up there? We keep getting scratching on the mic.
No, sorry.
It's just happening, huh? Okay, so I looked around the table twice here. I don't see it. Usually it's members bumping papers or something, but we're getting this that sound. So, all right.
Sorry.
Please continue. My apologies.
No problem. Gone are the days when things were included in a music lesson just for fun. The music room at Clover Ridge is still a place of joy, but each activity that is planned is now directly in the curriculum. Students are progressing through the material more quickly, learning the concept more deeply, and are assessed in a more regular and meaningful way. I am more accountable to my students and to my colleagues for ensuring that the concepts are taught in a timely manner. Minneapolis is currently hosting a music conference of music educators and administrators who have traveled from around the country. The annual conference of the Organization of American Kodai Educators is being held at the Minneapolis Hilton as we speak. Typically, session presenters submit an application a year in advance. A team of music educators then reviews these submissions. They select only the most relevant and high-quality applications. After the National Board of the OAKE heard about the work being done in the schools of Eastern Carver County under the guidance of the Perpich Center, we were sought out and invited to present. We had not submitted an application. We had not sought out the opportunity. The quality of work we completed, though, caught the notice of the conference planners and was deemed to be worthy of sharing with music educators from around the nation as a model for how future curriculums could be crafted. Minnesota students deserve our best. For the relatively modest investment the state makes in the Perpich Center each year, teachers are provided opportunities to delve more deeply into the best practices in music education. The ripple effect of changing a teacher is huge. Each teacher impacted returns to their classrooms and improves the music education experience for hundreds of students. In an age when we are emphasizing continuous progress and accountability through assessment, the Perpich Center brings to teachers of the arts what is usually only brought to a few subject areas. I strongly encourage you to continue providing this important service so that all of Minnesota students across our state can benefit from a high-quality arts education.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Sophie Bosar, and I'm a senior at the Perpich Arts High School in the theater program. And our communications director came to me and asked me to testify on behalf of the Perpich Arts High School, so I have a few brief written remarks. I remember clearly in seventh grade wondering if I could ever be happy where I was, if anything would ever change, if I would ever learn anything worth learning, and how long the next 6 years would be. And I can't tell you how much time I've spent wondering what good I did in some past life to deserve something like Perpich, to come across a tiny ad in the newspaper that became that light at the end of a long, dark tunnel. For a lot of kids, Perpich is a doorway to a more satisfying future. To some, it's a getaway. To some, it's even a safe house. And for some, it's still a high school. But regardless of any definition a student might give, they'll give you that smile that says, yeah, I'm happy here, because we are. I'm not entirely sure why anyone would want to replace a place like this. I realize money is tight and will be for a long time, but in times like this, we can't just disregard a source of hope for the future of my generation and generations to come. and also amazing young art that the residents of Minnesota have appreciated for over 20 years. And I can go on for hours about how much I love and appreciate the arts program, but I have to give so much credit to the academics at my high school. I never imagined academics as a valid, significant aspect of my life. At my old school, it was always show up, do the work, go home, do it again. At Perpich, the teachers give us a reason to get up at 6:30 or 7 in the morning and come to class on time. They give us a reason to go to class. They don't teach through art or alongside art. They teach each subject as an art itself. I don't ask why anymore because everything is important. And I like the homework. I never thought I'd say that. I wouldn't be where I am, and I wouldn't be going to New York or to my dream school or seriously pursuing my passion as a writer and actress. I wouldn't have any idea about a sense of belonging if it weren't for Perpich. Being here helped me find my place in the world, and I ask that you listen to me and take what I'm saying seriously, because I speak not only for the 300 students who are in my classes right now, but for the hundreds and thousands of others upon whom Perpich has had a significant impact. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Paul Basil. I'm the principal at Grand Meadow Public Schools. If you look in your packet, I did type something up. It's this brownish-colored paper, so I'll be brief, as many of the things I'm going to state are already in written form. I have been involved in the Perpich Center for about 6 or 7 years as an outstate principal. My first involvement was in Austin, Minnesota, where a CAP grant was written. And what it did is it brought all the music, all the art, and the biggest thing was Austin's a community of about 24,000 people, and they do have art opportunities there. What they were able to do is by collectively bringing people together was find out what will our mission be, and the biggest thing in Austin was to determine that we need to make people aware of what things are already happening in our community, because with a Fortune 500 business, there's a lot of different professionals that come into the community that are looking for things to do in the evenings and on the weekends. And so what we did is we created an awareness, a website, table toppers for information, so if people are going to get a bite to eat, they could say, oh, hey, we can go to the playoff, the college, or we can go over to the Paramount Theater. My second involvement was that with Worthington, Minnesota. Worthington is becoming a very diverse community, and one of the things that we were finding as a principal that was leading the journey of becoming a CAP recipient was we need to figure out how can we align our standards. As it was previously mentioned, that is a second part of their outreach program, is helping teachers learn what the standards are and then helping them align them. So they first came down and got all our standards aligned to the national level way before anything was actually in front of us. Once again, Nissa Brown's name is going to be brought up again. She's a phenomenal person that comes out. She's got teaching background. She helps everybody get things aligned. We also wrote a grant at that time, and before we knew it, we had over 30 people, retired teachers, community members, members that were involved with SMOC that would have connections with the Legacy Grant. And before we knew it, we had so many people that wanted to be part of this that we had to create subcommittees to keep everybody focused. Otherwise, meetings would go 2-3 hours. So that was the next piece that we worked on down there. They found out that dance was missing in the Phi-Ed area. So the focus was we brought dance back, and we're trying to create a diversification awareness before I left, and now I'm currently in Grand Meadow. Right now, Grand Meadow is a small school. Our town is about 945 kids, 376 students. We currently have a shared superintendent that's over three districts, so we're aware of what it means to have budget adjustments. The CAP, we're writing another CAP grant following where I'm at, so that we can incorporate five school districts to bring more arts awareness. And the Perpich Center, through the CAP program, has already brought all the art teachers, all the music teachers together to come up how we can focus. And even one of their things right now to finalize is their big picture, because Perpich is never satisfied with the status quo. You're not thinking big enough. You're not thinking innovative enough. You're not being creative enough. And it really forces people to be uncomfortable in a very positive way. This is what their mission is right now. They want to revitalize the small town main streets by creating art displays and music areas for kids to display the work that they do within their different schools. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak to all of you on behalf of the Purpich Center and what it's done for not only myself, but many, many teachers and thousands of kids across the outstate areas of southern Minnesota.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Pam Paulson, and I serve as the Senior Director of Policy at the Purpich Center for Arts Education. You have, I just want to focus on numbers for a few minutes as we close out our opportunity to speak with you. You have just heard from four constituents, but as Sophie said, and also Paul, that you need to keep in mind that there are thousands of students and teachers who are not able to be here today with you to share their stories about the positive impact that the Purpich Center programs and services have had on them. All 20 of you on this committee have students or teachers from your legislative district currently involved in Purpich Center programs or on the list of our new applicants for the junior class at the Arts High School, which are being reviewed right now. We do high-quality programming in your communities as well as at the Purpich Center for Arts Education. Approximately 25 years ago, which is when I started working for the Purpich Center, we started with the idea that the arts would be central to the school and to the education of these students. However, we predicted about 60% would not end up going into the arts for a career. They would go into all sorts of careers that require critical and creative thinking, which they learn in the arts. So we have had students go on to MIT. We have students becoming engineers, lawyers, architects, even Minnesota State Agency employees, technology wizards. And if you had been able to hear Rich Coeur speak, you'd find out that he is learning to be a military chaplain. Just this month, in March 2011, state demographer Tom Gillespie tells us that the jobs of the future will be those that require judgment skills. And he says you can't outsource critical thinking. In a new study that was sponsored by IBM, 1,500 CEOs of major corporations were asked what they thought would be the most important priority for leadership in the future, and 60% replied creativity. The Partnership for 21st Century Skills is composed of many of the largest corporations in the United States, including Adobe, Apple, Cisco, Dell, ETS, Hewlett, Intel, Microsoft, Oracle, Verizon, and even Walt Disney Companies, to name just a few of those that serve on the P21 Strategic Council. As business people, they are thinking about the future economy, and they list these skills as essential for our next generation: creativity and innovation, critical thinking, and problem solving. To close my remarks, when Ernst & Young released their 2010 report called Connecting Innovation to Profit, it gave us a wake-up call when they said, quote, "We assume that 50% of our new revenue in the next 5 years' time must come from sources that do not exist today." That is why we need to innovate. And that is why we need arts education in all of our schools statewide. We need educated, creative students to help design the future. They need to make a living, and they need to make a life. The Purpich Center wants to continue as a state agency, helping prepare students and teachers with 21st century skills that will be critical to their own achievement and to our economic future. Thank you for taking the last 40 minutes to hear the stories and a few important numbers about a highly successful arts and education agency that has played a very important role in Minnesota's overall education system. And there's just one more number. We look forward to another 25 years of being able to serve the students and teachers in each of your legislative districts. And if you have any questions for us, we are all here willing to answer.
Thank you, Ms. Paulson. And also, the Purpich Center is punctual. Finished on time. Thank you. We do have a parent who has come down. My understanding is they're not party or testifiers. who I believe they had a who would like to speak for 2 minutes. Is that okay with you? Is that all right? Okay. Mr. Rice, if you could please come down. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brian Rice. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis. I'm also a lobbyist, but I'm not here as a lobbyist today. I'm speaking in my capacity as a parent of a Purpich senior. I saw this on the agenda. 2 years ago, I testified in front of a the Education Committee in response to Governor Pawlenty's recommendation, and at that time, my son was just applying to go to Purpich. At the time, he was at a charter arts high school, one of two arts charter high schools in the in Minnesota, Main Street School for Performing Arts. And let me just say, I'm a product of Catholic education. I went to 16 years. My experience with the public education system was the University of Minnesota. I went to the University of Notre Dame, DeLaSalle High School, and the Catholic school in Minneapolis. So, and both of my sons had gone to private schools. One graduated from Breck. Connor had spent 8 years at Breck, but quite frankly, he was a square peg in a round hole, and that's a very good school. And he went to an arts a charter school, had a good experience there, wanted to further that, and went to Purpich. And I'm here as a 100% satisfied parent, and it's a great institution. I think it's a tremendous asset for the state of Minnesota to have in a variety of areas. The state's put a huge investment in it over the last nearly quarter century. I think it would be a tragedy for the state to give up on that. I do see the bill suggests that Purpich could reconstitute itself as a charter school. And as a parent who didn't know much about charter schools or that Purpich is a state institution, let me just say, it's been quite an education in the last 4 years. And for those on the committee, and you're probably much more knowledgeable than I about charter schools and state agencies, there's a huge, huge difference. The Main Street School is a very good institution, but it struggles quite a bit. And Purpich is just really at a totally different level. I live within about a mile of the institution, so I've met a lot of these kids. Connor brings them home. I can go around the table, and I know some of the kids' constituents. I made them dinner.
Tear it off.
Nope.
Hopefully that does it. I mean, I've had a chance to meet a lot of these kids around the state, and I mean, you might call it the Island for Misfit Toys or something like that. But it's really not that. These are very creative kids.
When this happens again, if you guys could just hit your mute buttons to see if it goes away, that'll tell us if it's up on the table or not. So just once it starts again, just everyone hit your button really quick. So,
I mean, these kids are really unique. There are treasures in Minnesota. I think the last speaker about what the next stage of innovation is really important, and I couldn't think of anything more foolish you could do than with all due respect to you, Mr. Chairman, to end this venture. You know, one of the things I learned, I'm still very close to my high school, De La Salle, the Christian Brothers. When they make a commitment to a school, it's not for one generation or two, it's for seven generations, because you're really not going to see the product of this investment for a long, long time. I mean, you're seeing it now, but to really bring it to fruition and see what it means to the state, I think this is just the state's got a huge investment in this, and I think it's just a wonderful place, and I think it's something that should be kept.
Thank you, Mr. Rice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just a couple of quick questions. One is, if you could cover the room and boarding costs when people attend the facility, if there's someone who could cover those items.
Mr. Chair, I would like to introduce Mike Zabel from the Purpich Center. He's our administrative management director and handles our financials.
Hi, my name is Mike Zabel, and I'm the administrative management director at the Purpich Center for Arts Education.
All right. So
Okay, so it's up. Is that a hidden bell?
No, so it must be up there. We'll have to take a look at the. Maybe we can if we can contact someone to have them come down and look at it. So.
Mr. Chair, could I get that question once more, please?
Sure. Room and boarding costs for those who, many of your students don't commute. They live there. If you just cover those.
The current fee for the students who reside on campus is $3,445.
And could you briefly discuss the ability to leverage legacy funds in the last couple of years?
Legacy funds?
No? Ms. Paulson, perhaps.
Mr. Chair, members, this biennium that we're currently in right now, the Purpose Center for Arts Education received $1 million from the Legacy Fund, Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. $300,000 were in the first fiscal year and $700,000 in the second fiscal year.
Thank you. Any questions for members of the committee? Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have had broad and conversations about education reform in the Reform Committee and this committee this year. And a long-standing concern of mine that has started to float up a little bit here is the persistent narrow emphasis on reading and math in the schools. And that a part of why we have not moved the needle on achievement in the last 10 years, 15 years in the state, we've tried tax credits, we've tried charter schools, we've tried open enrollment, we've tried all these things, and nothing seems to have shifted. I wonder if that isn't a part of the repeated error of focusing on a narrow curriculum and narrowing it and narrowing it and narrowing it. And you folks aren't a part of that. Can you comment on the role of arts in achievement in our schools, please?
Ms. Paulson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, I would say that everyone at the Purpose Center believes that reading and math are critical subject areas for every student to master. So we're not on the side of arts only. We are on the side of a complete education for students, because students will not learn any subject area if they are not engaged. They need to have some reason to attach themselves to the learning, and that is one of the reasons it's so critical, not the only reason, because the arts have their own set of learning standards and their own content and skills for children to learn. But we think that one of the ways that the arts can contribute to an overall education for students is to combine with those subject areas, create ways that are doorways or windows into the learning that engage the students. I have a learning disabled child. He had brain surgery when he was born, and I am still raising him at the age of 26. The only reason he is surviving, from my opinion, is that he has found photography as a way to express his voice. There are hundreds of children like that in our schools that need multiple ways to express their learning. The Purpose Center, with the legacy funds, is undertaking this kind of initiative, a pilot to integrate the arts more carefully and systematically into the curriculum for children to learn across the curriculum.
Now, Ms. Paulson, I got to ask you a question, and you got to be honest with me. Now, did you do some research on the chair and know that I love photography, or is that just random luck? Come on, be honest.
I didn't know it.
Okay. Really?
I really didn't.
So I was going to be impressed about your opposition research there. So, any other questions for members of the committee? Representative Briner.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a question, but I'm going to take my 2 or 3 minutes to follow in Brian Rice's footsteps, and I'm going to speak as a legislator, a citizen, and a mom. Many Mankato students have attended the Purpich Center for the Arts. My middle daughter graduated from Purpich in the year 2000. She went to Purpich as a visual artist and a very typical teenager, not knowing exactly what to do with all her brilliance and energy. She has since gone on to study graduate to geology and geophysics, and would be a great advertisement for the STEAM program, I would say, because Purpich fed her creativity and channeled her intelligence in ways that I think traditional high school just was not doing for her. Dozens of Mankato educators also participate in the Purpich Center in terms of arts training. The extraordinary opportunities and the high quality of the Purpich Center are so unique that, and it's such a Minnesota gem that I think we would be doing a grave disservice to our state as a whole if we were to anyway undermine the work that they're currently engaged in. It would be an incredible loss to our state, and Purpich embodies all the things this committee talks about all the time: engaged students, highly qualified teachers, and amazing levels of student achievement. So I encourage the committee to think cautiously about this bill.
Thank you, Representative Briner. Representative Anderson, then Ansells, then Slocum, then Greiling. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I believe one of the testifiers mentioned that the school, Purpich School, could not reopen as a charter school. Now, do you mean that literally or just in the sense that it would lose the focus, or could you explain that comment, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, in the current statutes for charter schools, it doesn't fit the current method and operation of the arts high school. On a number of fronts that, first of all, we'd have to conduct a significant amount of research to determine whether or not we could open anything similar or near similar to the Arts High School. But it's, again, charter schools located in a community to serve a particular need. Our focus on statewide is so very, very important that it would lose a good part of the flavor not to have the Sophies interject with students from the urban area as well. The admission requirements of the charter school are also different than what we have. That the way our program is established, the students have academic program classes in the morning, and in the afternoon they do have to choose one of six art areas, so they are thrust into a program. So it would not allow us to accept everyone. We don't accept everyone now. We accept students who have a passion for the arts and who have some ability and who want to be there. And we accept students who have the creative ability to think and learn better. But in a charter school, the rule, which we fully understand, of supporting whomever applies would be difficult for us to operate. The other aspect that, in terms of charter school, we have excellent teachers. We have superb teachers. They don't sit as members of the board of directors currently. We have a board that we're governed by, and it is appointed by the governor and approved by the Senate, of course. But part of the health of the organization is to have board members who aren't involved on a day-to-day basis with the organization, but who think outside the box and who bring a breadth and wealth of knowledge, whether it's the business community, so we understand needs for 21st century workers or philanthropists, etc. It would require a different kind of board. We are familiar with the wonderful school in St. Paul, the St. Paul Conservatory for the Performing Arts, and they rightly so chose performing arts, whereas we have six art areas, and it would be unlikely that in a charter school program it would be hard to do that without having the research and professional development arm of Purpich to rely upon as well. So it's just so significantly different than the organizational structure in place right now and that we see as the success of our history.
Representative Ansells.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been thinking really long and hard about the bill and the Purpich Center. And with full disclosure, I would want all of the committee members to know that it was in another capacity, actually, in the Purpich administration where I first became aware of Rudy and Lola's vision for the Perpich Center for the Arts. And in thinking about it, I want to tell you what I believe in my heart Rudy would say, Mr. Chair and committee members, if he could be here. And if he had decided that he wanted to impact this decision. Here's what he'd say. One of the jobs of state government is to set an example and to lead our partners in governing the citizens of the state of Minnesota. And there will be budget dilemmas. I don't think he envisioned one quite as bad as this one. But he would say, you have a budget dilemma and a budget crisis. And school districts have budget dilemmas and budget crises every year. And unfortunately, one of the first things to go, Rudy would say, are the arts. He'd say the arts are the first to go because there aren't 2,000 people in the football stadium on Friday nights, and there isn't the glamour, and there isn't the exposure, and there isn't the knowledge of just how important these arts are to young people and to communities. And so I think he'd say, we're going to create a state agency to demonstrate and to lead and to create an environment where the state citizens and school boards and superintendents and everybody in communities keeps in mind just how important the arts are, to raise awareness. And I think I know the Perpich Center has accomplished that mission. And I know Rudy would ask you to, with all due respect, Mr. Chair, to reject changing the emphasis of the Perpich Center to a charter school. So, and I say that very respectfully to you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Anzels. Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for coming and sharing with us again. I was there for the last presentation where you had to defend your program. It's a unique program that you offer. It's a statewide program that you offer. And as the chief author of the charter school reform legislation of 2009, it doesn't really fit. And you delineated that very clearly with the charter school scaffolding that we set up. It also takes a good couple years for the idea of a school to become a school through the process. And I think this would disrupt kids' education if we went this direction. And the charter school legislation was geared to a completely different scenario. So I think that we need to do more work with this, and I think we need to fund it, and the Perpich program. And, you know, as I sit here, and I'm just going to put in one plug for charters, there's a bill that's languishing somewhere in bill land in this body, and to extend for authorizers. I believe it's a Woodard bill. The ability for authorizers, for MDE to examine authorizers. We're going to lose a number of charter schools if we don't get on that bill and pass that. And I think that would be really a shame. These are existing schools. These are schools with track records and data. So, but this is such a separate program that we really need to keep the validity and the integrity of this program.
Thank you, Representative Slocum. And just a reminder to members of the committee that this year is different. The finance deadline is before the policy deadline. So while there certainly will be some policy this weekend unveiled in the bill, the conversation, unlike in previous years, the conversation on the policy front will be continuing to move forward. And with regards to those policies that have financial policy, this committee will be continuing to move forward. Representative Dryland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, I, of course, have sat through this sort of hearing on the school before, too, but I do think it's a good idea to have the hearing because we do have a lot of new members, and so to introduce the new members to Purpich and how it is a statewide school, I think is not all bad, Mr. Chair. I would say to the new members, if you haven't, it's because this bill came up at the last minute. If it had a little more lead time, there's alumni in addition to the current students all around the state that we would be hearing from if this bill should be considered seriously. But I'm hoping, Mr. Chair, that like Governor Purpich, who popped this in his bill at the very last minute, I remember talking to Commissioner Alice Segrin the very day that the bill came out, and until it came out, she didn't know it was going to be in the bill, so it had been really popped in at the last minute. But here we are with bill deadlines coming up. We in the minority are chomping at the bit to get the bill and so forth, and hope to have it soon. So I'm hoping this, like Governor Purpich's, is kind of a last-minute fling, and that once we get done with this hearing, we will give it a good fling.
Did you mean Governor Pawlenty put it in his bill?
Pardon me?
You meant Governor Pawlenty.
Did I say Purpich?
You did.
Representative Ansells, you're a bad influence on me again.
Thank you. Last question goes to Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, the folks from Purpich, for the testimony. And I heard a lot of reasons why the Purpich Center is a great thing and all the great things that it does. I just want to ask a question of the author to take the committee through the policy rationale as to why we're going to be why this proposal has come about, I guess.
Sure. And Representative Peterson, members of the committee, I guess first of all, any closing comments from the testifiers? Okay, thank you. So the chair will renew his motion to have House File 1078 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. So thank you very much, Representative Peterson. To your question. I think that, you know, obviously the state is under financial pressure right now, and one of the things that we're doing is we're defending a target that is unusual compared to other committees, and we have to look at those priorities that are out there and what's being funded and how the best use of those dollars will be allocated, and that would be the chief driver, I would say, for this legislation. Thank you. So thank you again to the testifiers for coming in. We greatly appreciate you taking your time to come in and share your thoughts with us and sharing with us the history and the vision for the Purpich Arts, Purpich Center for the Arts. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Do you have testifiers?
Yes, I do.
Okay. You can get it done, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Representative Dabney moves that House File 1056 be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill.
Yeah, it would have been a good one. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, committee. Members, I want to be brief in my comments and walk through the bill because the folks who are up here with me can tell more about the bill and the opportunities it provides than I can. I want to take those of you who were at the luncheon with Secretary Duncan back to that day. And I'm going to paraphrase, but the chair was pretty excited about Secretary Duncan that day, and he can check me on my quote or verbatim quote of the secretary when he said, you know, come on, folks, it's about teachers, it's about standards, it's about curriculum, it's about families, let's get it done. And then David Olson, the president of the state chamber, got up and said, great speech, Mr. Secretary, thank you so much. What is it we do about families? And the secretary said, I don't know. And he said, nobody seems to know. Well, we're Minnesota, and I think we're smarter than Illinois. And I think the folks here with me actually do know what to do about families, how to connect them to schools, and how that connects with achievement for everyone. Quickly to walk through the bill, this would propose a grant program that would fund target grants to schools throughout the state for targeted training of teachers, administrators, and staff, as well as parents, targeted at three groups of schools, the lowest identified lowest performing schools in the state, those experiencing high rates of poverty, as measured by, of course, by free and reduced lunch, and those experiencing rapid demographic change, recognizing that that can be challenging for a school as the population shifts. It requires the Commission of Education to assure that the grants have statewide distribution, and I think importantly, and the speakers may go to this as well, it requires that recipient schools or districts match $1 for every $4 of grant to ensure that they have skin in the game, that they step up their commitment to actively engaging parents. With that, I have three testifiers here today, Lori Lindblad and Vicki Wunsch from the Family Partnership, and Mr. Joe Wimmett from the Robbinsdale Area Schools, and I, Roseville, pardon, sorry, oh good, Greiling isn't in the room. the Roseville Area Schools, I think you will find the passion that they bring to these this program to be infectious, as I have. And with that, I would like to hand it over to Vicki. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Vicki Wunsch, and I am a coordinator with the Family Project, which is a program of the Family Partnership. And the Family Project, the best way to describe it is that we are a cost-effective and efficient way for schools to engage families. And primarily we work with schools as schools that are experiencing a changing demographic. We know that it's not just the urban schools anymore that are changing demographic. We know that the achievement gap is statewide. And so one of our main goals is to work with schools in a more purposeful way so that all of their family engagement activities are actually streamlined and they can be basically completed or strategized around the achievement gap. Many of the schools that we work with have a lot of different ways that they engage parents and engage families. Most of those ways are not related to academic success at all. And so we want to work with schools, and we have worked with schools, around how do you link purposeful family engagement to academic success. And one of the things that we do is we work with schools to try to get them to see that parents are partners in their child's education. And for many schools we work with, it is the parents or the teachers, or the teachers are the ones responsible for teaching and the parents have no responsibility at all. And what we are trying to do is actually work with the both of the families, the parents and the teachers, to see that we're both responsible for their child's education. What that means, though, is training schools on how to work with a diverse group of parents. Many of the school districts that we've been working in, as you heard, are changing, have a rapidly changing demographic, and many of the schools are saying, we know that family engagement is really important. We've heard it. We've seen it on the news. We know that it's linked to the achievement gap and how we engage families. The problem is many of the schools don't know how to do that. The PTA or PTO model of parent engagement does not work anymore. And so what we are coming up with basically a model that we know is a best practice in how to engage families, help parents see themselves as educators, and also help schools to be able to evaluate and look at data related relating to family engagement and the achievement gap and academic success.
Hello, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lori Lindblad. I'm the director of the Family Project. And as Vicki was saying, this model really is looking to help schools be very purposeful in the kind of activities and time and money they spend on family engagement. The model we work with is not a cookie. It is not a cookie cutter approach. We know that each school is different, and the way that we work with schools is to really help the schools look at who their student population is, who their the parents are of the student population, and ways that are going to be the most effective to really partner with those families. There's been quite a bit of research done on effective family engagement strategies. One of the main researchers in this area is the Harvard Family Research Institute, and their studies, which have been going on for about 40 years now, have looked at the fact that when you increase the increased involvement of parents and when you develop meaningful relationships between parents and schools, What you get is positive educational outcomes, which help shrink the achievement gap, improve student performance, and ultimately keeps kids in school. This evidence shows that the family involvement is probably one of the strongest predictors of children's school success. I think it's something that many of us understand intuitively, that when families are supporting education in the home and know how to do that, kids are often quite successful in school. What this model does is really help schools look at how can we work and reach the families who we maybe are having the hardest time reaching and partnering with to promote success with kids. So one of the things that Harvard has taught us, that over 40 years of research suggests that family engagement promotes, really does promote, a wide range of benefits for students, including improved school readiness, higher student achievement, better social skills and behavior, and in the increased likelihood of high school graduation, all things that are very important to us in Minnesota. There was a study that Harvard did that looked at parents who participated in academic enrichment activities with their children for an average of less than 12 weeks, and the kids whose parents participated in this with them, studies showed that they gained 4 to 5 months gains in reading and math compared to the students of the families who did not participate. And what that's telling us is when you work with parents and really help them see how they can contribute to the academic success and partner with the school, the gains are quite considerable. We also know that children spend 70% of their waking hours outside of school. So children do not live at the school. And we need to really then find ways that we can engage parents in reducing the achievement gap. They need to be partners at that table. We also know that it'll be difficult, if not impossible, to reduce those gaps if we don't put a lot more attention on how to invest and involve parents who may be economically or otherwise disadvantaged, which is what the Family Project that we have been working with does. Now, our particular model has been in existence for 10 years and is very much aligned in what research is telling us works. And as I mentioned before, we do target the families that schools typically have a hard time engaging. We have worked over the past years with over 15,000 adults and kids, and 86% of those family members have been people of color, so students and their parents of color. A couple of examples just of the successes that we've had that we find very promising is, one is in the Northfield School District that has had a pretty rapidly changing student demographic. And over the course of the 2009-2010 school year, we engaged over 550 students, 250 adults, in family nights, that we call them, brought these students and their families to the school. And these were Title I parents at a school in Northfield that was struggling the most. What the school saw was a 45% increase of family engagement at the school due to these efforts. And not only that, this particular school, Greenvale Park, improved on its adequate yearly progress targets, and it met all of its proficiency targets except for one, which was an improvement from the previous year where three had not been met. So what we see there is parents coming and feeling comfortable and connecting at the school and participating, and we also see improved academic achievement. And lastly, I'll just say an example has been at a school in St. Paul, Cherokee Heights, where we focused on working with the students, first and second graders, who were not reading at grade level. And we've talked, been hearing about the performing arts. We know that that's important. We also know that kids need to be able to read to be able to be successful later on. So literacy is a very important thing at that young age, that kids really are getting a solid grasp of that. And at Cherokee Heights, we saw an increase of 12% in the reading scores from the previous years. And actually, Cherokee Heights scored higher than any other school in St. Paul District as far as the gains that were made. And with that, I'd like to hand things over to Joe Wimette, Assistant Superintendent at the Central School.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Joe Wimette. I'm the Assistant Superintendent for Roseville Area Schools. And I've been in working in this capacity for the last 6 years. In the previous year, 20 years previous to that, I worked in the neighboring school district. So I have known of Roseville for a long time. And Roseville, I think it's always been a school district that has prided itself very much on high performance among students and student achievement. Roseville in the last 10 years has experienced pretty dramatic change in both ethnic demographics and poverty. I can tell you that about 10 years ago, 18% of Roseville students were students of poverty. In the last school year, in 2009, our statistic was 36%, so that was a doubling of that. In the 34%, I'm sorry, it was almost a doubling. And then in the last school year, we jumped from 34 to 40, almost 41% of our students are participating in the free and reduced lunch program. So that's a pretty rapidly escalating change in our climate and in our family situations. And I know that one of the goals of this bill is to work with families and what's the termed underlying issues of the whole family. And certainly I think of education as a partnership with families. And our work with the Family Project a dramatic question was asked in my first work with the Family Partnership, and it was, what is your vision for parent engagement in your school district? Well, we've spent the last year with the Family Partnership's help exploring exactly that concept. What is our vision for family engagement with us as a school district to enhance student achievement? And we've had a lot of dialogue with ourselves and with our families about the nature of true partnership with families with respect to our efforts to maximize student achievement, to diminish the achievement gaps that we see as a very real thing as part of our school district and throughout the state. So I think in terms of wise use of resources, wise use of time and effort, this opportunity to truly partner with families on behalf of their students is a wise thing to look forward to.
Thank you very much. Representative Dabney, do you have any closing comments before we move to questions from members?
Not at this time, no, Mr. Chair.
Any questions from members of the committee? Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to borrow one of my favorite terms from one of my favorite legislators, where to begin? This is an interesting idea, and I certainly commend you all for the work that you do. And I know that we've got a few other bills to talk about, so I just want to kind of limit my questions to one, and that is, Representative Dabney, we have three different designations on what an eligible school is, and one of them is a lowest performing school. And we've obviously had lots of discussion about what a low-performing school looks like, and there's been some concern on the part of the committee that we tag schools as lower-performing and that may be harmful on their psyche by calling them low-performing. What is your intent here for the commissioner to decide what a low-performing school is, and just kind of talk a little bit about that, if you will.
Representative Dan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Woodard. We've already identified 32 low-performing schools in the state. It came through, and there are smarter folks around the table than I, but it was federal designation. It was tied to last year's ARRA funds, if I recall correctly. That would be a fine place to start targeting those 32 schools, or I guess not targeting, offering the opportunity to those schools. As we roll forward, hopefully things like targeted family outreach and other efforts helps bring those schools out of that designation. We can then look at how the definitions that exist apply or don't apply to other schools, tweak them so that somebody has to graduate at the bottom half of the medical school class. Somebody is always going to be at the bottom of the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, I guess I will backtrack on what I said of only one question. I have one more question. Yeah. That'll show up on a campaign brochure somewhere.
he's officially not a freshman anymore. Now he's done it. So, Representative Woodard.
And you mentioned that PTOs and PTAs really aren't the right model anymore. Can you kind of expand upon that? What is different about what you're doing versus what existing organizations that Roseville might have that would be different than what you're proposing here?
To the testifiers.
Thank you. One of the things that historically, you know, the PTO or PTA, and each school calls them different things, started in the 1950s. And it's probably one of the few things that we have kept the same over the last 50 years that hasn't really changed. And what has come out of that is that people view the PTA or PTA as mainly a fundraising group. It's most of the schools we work with, the PTA, PTO meetings are during the day. They're still designed to get stay-home moms to come, and we know that families are not necessarily that anymore. And so most of the schools that we have been working with, they still have their PTO or PTA, but they also are aware that that is not the only place that parents can plug into. That there is a need for fundraising, there's a need for some kind of governance like the PTA, PTO, but what we're also looking for is how do parents actually support their kids' education, and the PTO, PTA doesn't really address that so much as it does now look at fundraising, more of the administrative parts of school, rather than how do we engage parents in the school and the everyday life of the school.
Just as a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair, so are there efforts underway from your group to work with the PTA and the PTO in order to change that perspective?
Yes, thank you. Okay. One of the school districts that we had mentioned was in Northfield, and their PTA at one of the elementary schools was, they actually had three parents on their PTA committee, and the representation from the students was not matching the three people that were on the PTA. And so what happened was, basically, their goal was not to start another way to engage families, but to change the goal of their PTA. To engage parents that may not have even stepped foot in the door, parents that have no idea what the PTO or PTA is. And so what they did was, when we would bring all these families in for a gathering or a meal, we always had people from the PTO, PTA there talking about what the role of the PTA is. And in 1 year, just by having that relationship started, they went from three people to 26 people on their PTA, and it's now completely bilingual. So it definitely changed. They did not get rid of their PTO, PTA, and we work alongside of often the PTO, PTA groups in a school. And most of them recognize that this is a different way to do family engagement. It's not in competition whatsoever. We're not trying to start a new PTA or a takeover of anything like that kind, but that we work in partnership with them.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Dabney. Interesting proposal. I had a few questions, and maybe I'll start just by keying off a little bit of what Representative Woodard was asking, because my things that I did in my community before I ran for office was serving as chair of our PTO. And in Eden Prairie, we have a significant Somali population, and I noticed after the first meeting, and our meetings were in the evening, and we did get huge attendance, but it was, you know, where are the Somali moms or dads? And we figured out that, you know, we need to have an interpreter so that they can understand what's going on, because a lot of their children maybe speak English, but a lot of the parents don't. And so that's one of the things we did. So, you know, while I think this is an interesting idea, I'm just wondering, I mean, how many schools really aren't kind of figuring this out? I mean, it didn't take a grant and folks coming in after the first meeting and parents weren't there that, you know, the other group of moms sitting at the table said, we need to do something about this, and we just did it.
Perhaps I could respond to that idea, Mr. Chair. At least in our experience in our school district, it isn't either or, but it's both and. Each of our schools does have a parent group. And each of our schools is well aware that that group of parents isn't sufficient for encompassing what parent engagement is at schools. And if I could talk about one particular school, Edgerton Elementary School isn't too far from here. And that principal reached out specifically, the principal and staff reached out specifically to the Hispanic portion of their population saying, what can we do to help you? And specifically and explicitly invited Hispanic families to school in a manner that was comfortable to them, asking them questions. And these are things, strategies that we learned in our work with the Family Project about the need to ask the groups of families what would be meaningful to you, what would be helpful to you, how can we help and breathe meaning into our partnership together, and found incredible response from that segment of their population in a way that the parent group officially just didn't. So it's not either or, and it's certainly not competition, but it's we need the parent group, we need that formal structure, but we're learning, I think, that we need to go beyond that formal structure and ask questions and create spaces that didn't exist before.
Mr. Yeah, Chairman.
So testifier wanted to say something.
I would say Mr. Chair, the other thing that I think is important to say is that because we want to link family engagement efforts to academic success of all kids, it is a very different function than the PTA. So we want the parents to be in the classroom. We want the parents to be asking, you know, what is a standardized test? What does grade level mean? What book should my child be picking out at the library? For those of us that are parents, we might know that our kids are going to naturally go for something easy. And so we want to help parents actually support their kids' literacy by, you know, picking out the best books for them. And that's the kind of involvement that we're looking at, which is at a different way of involving the parents than typically the PTA or PTO. And I'm amazed at how many schools don't naturally do this. We always say that this is kind of a natural program or initiative, but what it takes is just to step back a little bit and sort of think more strategically about where we're putting money for family involvement. A lot of the schools we work with have a huge carnival. They are plugging money into trying to get parents involved and can't do it. And so what we do is go in and help assess, you know, you're spending a lot of money on this. Perhaps if you want to relate it to academic success, it might make more sense that you spend the money doing it this way. And in that way, it's helping schools really look about where, not necessarily where they can spend more money, because we know that schools, it's not there, but it's how to spend the money more strategically, more, I guess, smarter, in a way that sees parents and helps how actually seek out parents that can support their child's education, and parents have the capacity to do that.
Thank you. And just kind of a quick follow-up, and maybe best to the assistant superintendent for starting, but you know, you were talking about in your school, Roseville Schools, about the rapidly escalating number of free and reduced lunch students you have. And I'm just wondering, you know, in this proposal, because obviously we've been coming through a really difficult economic time when my guess is a lot of families who weren't free and reduced lunch eligible have fallen into that level. So are you seeing a different groups of kids coming into your school with that designation, or kids who have been in your school whose family income levels have now fallen? I mean, or I'm trying to get a handle on what's driving that. And then secondly, the question is, I see real differences here in dealing with families struggling with poverty issues, and then just cultural differences that a lot of our teachers weren't trained to deal with that they are dealing with now in schools. And I see those as two kind of separate issues, although there's overlap. So that's my question.
The testifiers.
Poverty and culture definitely overlap when it comes to the school, and how families interact with the school are so closely connected, I think. And we just can't separate the two. It happens to be in our circumstance that both the ethnic demographics of our district and the poverty rates have escalated in that same period of time. So we're seeing both. We're seeing the families that you're talking about, some of the same families whose economic status has changed, but we're also seeing an influx of more diverse families in our communities at the same time. So we do see both. There's another school, and the impact has been an interesting impact to watch, and we're not done with this work at all. We're in the middle of creating this vision for parent engagement. In another school, a principal and staff members chose to, in August, go out and create a barbecue in a trailer home community, which was a first, a real first for the school going out into this portion of their school area and saying, we're coming to you and we'd like to get to know you, we'd like you to get to know us, in a little different way and to have some of that dialogue that Vicki was talking about that is very helpful dialogue that doesn't happen in the formal structure of that parent group organization. So it's really asking questions and being sensitive to how you establish those working relationships that maximize the partnership that we're all about for those kids who are coming into the school doors.
If I might add just a
few. Please.
The model that we've developed has some components that are very key to its success. One of them is that this model is relationship focused. So what we're talking about is the how you do this also, almost as much as the what, and certainly also the why, but how you do this. And so we really do set this up in a way so when Mr. Wimmett talked about creating the space, we create space so conversations will begin to happen and relationships begin to be built, because through those relationships that we are able to support our children. And often the families that we're talking about have not been at the table participating in those partnerships. That's what this model is quite effective in doing. And the other thing that I would like to add is that this is a strength-based focus model. So it takes really root in that everyone has something to offer, and that all of the families out there are untapped resources that we need to learn to tap into in order to have those resources be contributed to our school communities and to the success of our children. And when you come from a strength-based perspective and attitude, it is amazing how responsive people are also to wanting to participate, because it just feels good. So when you start looking for the resources, you often see them. If you're not looking for them, you don't see them. So that's one of the things that this model does that's very different from many other initiatives that have been tried before.
And Representative Fabian, you get the last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I'd like to say thank you to Mr. Representative Woodard for the little Freudian slip over there when you talked about Roseau versus Roseville. My next goal is to get Representative Bills and Greiling to sometime introduce themselves as being from Roseau. Rosemont, Roseville, whatever. That being said, my concern is a little bit about one size fitting all with regards to the grants and so forth, and then being from Roseau, which is a ways away from here. How would the services get there, you know, in a somewhat fiscally efficient manner, and the one size fits all for the $50,000 grant, realizing that it can be changed by the commission and so forth? I'd just like some reaction to that, please. Thank you.
The testifiers.
Thank you. This model, the way this model works is that our staff, who we actually call coaches, trainers and coaches, work with the existing school personnel to help them develop new ways of engaging families. So our staff are very mobile. They're in the schools really acting as consultants and coaches, helping this grow in each school. So that is why it really isn't a cookie-cutter approach, because our staff are trained to really look at each school community and help that school really see what is specific and different about our community, what are the strengths that we have here, what are some things where we could use a little bit more help, and then we work alongside the school as the school implements the model. So it's not a training and then we say good luck with it, but we train and then we continue to consult and coach as implementation takes place and help evaluate after each school year is over.
Representative Devney, any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, briefly, thank you very much for the opportunity to present the bill. I am just more and more convinced that over the last 10 or 15 years, we've tried choice opportunities, we've implemented standards, and then we've reviewed and tweaked those standards, we've looked at curriculum, we've changed teacher licensure, we've done all sorts of things, and we've seen incremental increase in achievement. What we've failed to do on a bipartisan basis is look at the kids and the families that come into that school. And I'm willing to ask the question of whether we have the courage to kind of cross the bridge from the top-down approach that we tend to like and instead come in at the grassroots with a strengths-based approach that works and actively engages the children and the families in the school, and look to the research that demonstrates gains in achievement through that different approach. With that, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. With that, Representative Dabney renews his motion to have House File 1056 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you. Representative Greiling, you got a question for me?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell everybody what the good news?
Well, first things first, members, as we announced yesterday, there'll be no Sunday committee hearing. There'll be no Saturday committee hearing as well. I'll still be here in taxes, but that's beside the point. The goal right now is we want to try to get the bill released to the public on Friday evening or Saturday morning, afternoon. We'll make sure we get that available up on the Internet and to the public, also given to the minority. What we will do is we'll take public testimony on Monday morning, allow that testimony to proceed, and then we will recess and come back Monday evening and begin the process of taking amendments. Should we complete the amendments, we'll be done. If we're not done, we will come back Tuesday morning and complete the amendments on Tuesday morning. So that is the schedule right now, Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just thank you so much on behalf of everyone in this room. That's so much more reasonable, and even more so for people who aren't in this room who might want to track what we're doing.
Thank you, Representative Greiling. Just two announcements, members. Number one, please keep House File 947, House File 558, and 1093 in your packets for this evening's hearing. Also, members, unfortunately, we're in the dungeon tonight. We're down in the basement, so we will not be coming back to 5. Just point out, and I know people will run around and still not listen to this, but please come back after the meeting in the basement. Listen for an announcement on the House floor on when that meeting will be. So, members, we are recessed to the call of the chair. Thank you. Members, we'll reconvene this meeting of the Education Finance Committee. The first item on our agenda is House File 101093. The chair will move House File 1093 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Members, very briefly, what this is known as the 7030 bill, which would require that direct classroom expenditures of those which are defined in the bill would have to be 70% of all expenditures at a local school district level. Superintendents would verify this. However, a school district or charter school that was unable to meet the expenditure standards under this could apply to the commissioner for a waiver for this and have it done. Also in subdivision fine, there's an exemption that says that a district that's in statutory operating debt that has an approved plan or has received an extension from the department to file a plan to eliminate the SOD is exempt from the requirements of this bill. If a district was below the 70% amount, what would happen is that there would have to be a plan submitted for the K-12 general operating expenditures or a district that were spent in the classroom, a plan within 3 years to reach that level. So that is my presentation for the bill. We'll take comments and testimony from the public. Is there anyone from the public who wishes to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everyone. Just real briefly, I'm Valerie Dilson. I represent a number of different groups, but here I'm speaking for the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials. And just very briefly, we oppose the legislation. In a year when the legislature is trying to reduce mandates, this is an additional mandate on school districts. It also, I think, assumes that everything in the class outside of the classroom is bureaucracy and administration. The cost that you can count towards instructional expenditures doesn't count things such as library support, school nutrition, heating and lighting, cleaning, maintaining classrooms and computer labs, and we feel that those are all part of the normal education day for the child. And then lastly, just this ties the hands of school leaders when we really should be giving them more flexibility to be innovative. And thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Ms. Bilsland. Are there any questions for members of the committee? Thank you. Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since you represent the business, it's
Ms.
getting
Bilsland.
Late.
The school finance people.
The school finance people, yes. Generally speaking, across the state, where are schools with as far as what they put into the classroom directly?
Can
you give me kind of a run, or is it, I'm sure it's different with every district, but is there an average of what goes in?
Ms. Nelson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Slocum,
when the bill was introduced, I tried to see if that information was available, but I was not able to get that for the hearing today. I have information. This is not a new concept. This bill has been around. The last time, I believe, was 2005 or 2006. And we have information from back then, but clearly that was a long time ago and it's probably not accurate. It would just give you a very rough idea.
Okay. Representative Slocum, any follow-up?
How about the rough idea? Mr. Chair, excuse me. How about the rough idea? Just to ballpark it.
So Ms. Doslin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Slocum, I can certainly get that to you.
Okay.
Email is okay.
That.
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Slocum, my apologies.
The other question, I have a question for you as the sponsor. Well, I guess, Representative Harrison.
Okay.
I'm just getting ready for the next
she's
bill.
Next.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
I'll answer just a question about, is there like a ramp-up time? Is there time for districts that are below this level to ramp up to it?
In the bill.
I looked at it and I didn't see that, Mr. Chair. I'm
no,
sorry.
No, it's okay. If you look at subdivision 2, it says if a direct classroom expenditures of a school district or charter school in fiscal year 12 or later are less than 70%, the district or charter school must submit a plan to the commissioner to reach that 70% threshold within 3 years.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but Representative Slocum asked the question I was going to ask. Okay.
Any other questions for members of the committee? Any other members of the public wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion to have House File 1093 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you. Representative Erickson. Representative Erickson moves House File 947 for possible inclusion in a later bill, and I have a DE2 amendment. Is that your amendment, Representative Erickson?
Mr. Chair, it is my amendment, but Mr. Chair and members, I did not make deadline because Ms. Larson and I did a few iterations of this, and so what I'd like to do is walk you through the amendment and then hope that I can offer it if this is included in the omnibus bill.
May I ask Representative Dabney, is that okay, or would you prefer that she walk through the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I don't see a problem with this.
Thank you for asking.
Thank you very much, Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, I would like to offer.
Representative Erickson moves the DE2 amendment. To your amendment, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have deleted the mandatory involvement of all school districts, charter schools, and intermediate districts in the alternative teacher pay, which we call QCOMP. And what I have done is kept the, so the fiscal note does not apply. I have kept the changes in section 1 so that a lot of what was in the original legislation no longer has to be followed because the emphasis that I'm moving this proposal two is that all districts begin to develop, all districts who are participating in QCOMP begin to develop an alternative teacher pay plan. There are some drafting errors, by the way, and Ms. Larson will make those corrections. So when you see school site, that will be taken care of when it appears in some of the other places. In section 2 of the bill, to prepare for the alternative teacher professional pay system, I've offered a couple of different ideas that I'd certainly like you to react to as a school, a district, I should say, or a charter school or an intermediate district is establishing an alternative salary schedule that does not use seniority to award compensation. I have offered what now is an I or a small one that we would use longitudinal data on, and then I have listed academic student growth, student attendance, student engagement, and connection with other outcome measures and other locally selected measures of student learning explicitly aligned with the elements of curriculum for which teachers are responsible, and made that 50% a part of that pay professional system, as long as that is designed and teachers are held accountable to that. And then in addition to that, data from parent surveys, an annual evaluation performed by a trained school administrator, and other performance measures such as student surveys, peer observations and review, teacher performance portfolios, video classroom observations combined with teacher reflection, and other highly reliable research-based measures. I was hoping that might allay some of your concerns so that it isn't so prescriptive. And then the language change for charter schools so that they don't have to have this vote of 70%. And then not finally, but in section 4, cleaning up the language so that the commissioner has 30 business days to review the applications. And then finally, a reapplication process in section 5 for all charter schools, intermediate schools, or school districts that are now participating in what we call quality compensation, or QCOMP. So that, Mr. Chair, is the amendment. I have had a suggestion come to me from superintendents who do have QCOMP, and they wish that I could work in some place where the code of ethics is referred to. So, Mr. Chair, maybe we'll consider that if this is included at some point. But basically, this redesign of the alternative teacher pay is, I'm trying to be consistent with what I think will be a future teacher appraisal system. With that said, I'll stand for questions.
Members, any questions regarding the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the form that the author would like? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The DE2 amendment is adopted. Representative Erickson, any other comments regarding your bill? I guess you did walk through your bill, didn't you?
I did. I walked through the amendment, which is now before us. I just want to say that I've been reading a lot lately, new literature that's come out, and it seems that the opinion of the writers, and I'm referring now to John Merrill, who wrote Influence of Teachers, really does focus on teacher evaluation and rewarding teachers for the good work they do in the classroom. And so I'm hoping that this is seen by you and by those who are involved in quality compensation now or the alternative teacher pay system as a reward, not as a punishment, not in any way to not say that not all teachers, you know, deserve this, because all teachers do deserve this, but now there's going to be a system by which they work toward a different goal from perhaps what is occurring now in our QCOMP plans. And so when I first undertook this project, really my goal was to make the alternative pay system prevail across districts that want to use this as an incentive, but also to focus on teacher effectiveness.
Thank you. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns about the bill? Doesn't look like it. With that, we'll close the public portion, testimony portion of our bill, and take members from questions from members. Any questions from members? Representative Henderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative, good bill. I've heard a couple of comments, mainly, I guess, from schools already in QCOMP that they have to reapply. Why is that, and is there any way that they could be put into this new program without having to reapply?
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, that's an excellent question. Well, the reapplication, I think, is necessary if indeed this becomes law. They are going to have to move to an alternative teacher pay system that is premised on what is the new language at the bottom of 2 and top of 3. And what I found in reviewing the plans that are in effect now, they don't have necessarily a purpose such as that which I'm suggesting here, which means they'd have to rewrite them anyway. Maybe there is a way that we could bypass that. Maybe a review by the commissioner would be adequate. And I think that's something we can work on if the chair decides to put this in the omnibus bill. But I think there are ways to get around that. But I took it out last night, and then after sleeping on it, I had Ms. Larson put it back in. So, you know, I'm struggling with it too, but I thought better to have it in than not, and then we can talk about ways that we can address. Even my school district in Princeton is concerned about it.
Representative Anderson? Any other questions for members of the committee? Representative Kelly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erickson, I guess I want to thank you for your efforts here, because I think as we've gone through a lot of these reforms and some questions and comments have come up and said that, you know, we need to ease into this. You know, why can't we take a year? Let's move into it. And I see that you're doing that, and I think hopefully that says that, you know, we're serious about the reform, not to the point where we want to just run things through, but we're thinking about this and really need it to work. So I appreciate your efforts here.
Any other questions? Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I QComp raises teacher pay. I like that. As a teacher in particular, I like that. It's a way to raise teacher salaries. And I think, by and large, given what we do, we spend all day with your children, teachers are underpaid. And this is a way to raise teacher salaries. Can measure it with what the teacher does to improve their practice, and we all work to do that in an ongoing way. The auditor's office, though, came out with a report in 09, I think it was, that said that QComp really was inadequate in linking it to student success. Do you have a response to that, or how have you addressed that in this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. My comment to that is that when alternative teacher pay was first introduced, first proposed, and I'm not sure if you were serving then, but I was, the intent was that we would convert from steps and lanes to this new system. Well, in the compromise in conference committee, that all changed, and so this became more of a Let's involve teachers in staff development, improve their teaching as much as possible, but not focus on achievement, student achievement. So I'm trying now to go back to the original intent, but also emphasize that reward that should come for excellence in teaching has to be based on the longitudinal data that I'm asking for, which I hope the department would be here to respond to, because I did reread through the study today, and you know they have parts of it ready. But I think we have to focus on that, especially if we're going to have the teacher appraisal system, which I think eventually will focus on student achievement and school-wide achievement in charter schools.
Representative Slocum. Any other questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, any closing comments, Representative Erickson?
Well, Mr. Chair, I am going to ponder the superintendent's calls to me about code of ethics. Suddenly, it seems to be an important thing to them. Oh, I don't think it's suddenly, but when they think about this, maybe some reference to the code of ethics as they deal with that part on the top of page 3, perhaps that could be worked in. And I'll see. We'll see what happens if you include it, Mr. Chair. So I look forward to having more debate on this.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. With that, Representative Erickson renews her motion to have House File 947, as amended, laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you. Representative Downey. Representative Downey moves House File 558. For possible inclusion in a later bill.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Would it be appropriate to move the A3 amendment as well at this point?
What's the date today? Are we? Representative Dabney, is it okay if we...
Oh, right, yep.
Let me get to it.
Missed an hour.
This is yesterday. Yeah. Given the staff's level of workload these days, I think you're within the standard deviation.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Thank you. It is appreciated. Representative Downey moves the A3 amendment. Representative Downey to the A3 amendment, please.
Yeah, this actually adds a section from Representative Mariani's previous bill in his delete all that adds the alignment index provisions, so that we actually do put that in and have that as an important mechanism to make sure that we don't have teachers with grade inflation not getting the feedback that their grades are not lined up with the test scores that their students are achieving as a way to give that feedback to them and improve what they're doing in the classroom.
Any questions on the A3 amendment? Representative Briner.
Sorry. Representative Downey, so I haven't read the recent version of your bill, but do you have end of course test in here?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Briner. Yes, and if it would be okay, maybe we get the amendment in, and then I can walk through the process and what the total contents of the bill are so that there's some context to even understand it. Yeah.
Yes, thank you. That's fine, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions on the A3 amendment? If not, Representative Downey moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor? Answer by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? A3 amendment is passed. To your bill, Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick recap of how this bill actually came together, and then I can do a quick walkthrough on the provisions. Those of you who were part of the K-12 committees 2 years ago remember that we delayed the implementation of the graduation requirement for the 11th grade math test for a variety of reasons and after lengthy discussion. And so the first section of this bill simply turns that graduation requirement back on a year earlier than the delay had previously prescribed. So right now it's scheduled to turn back on as a graduation requirement in 2014, and the first section simply says we will do that in 2013 as compared to waiting the full 5 years, given that we didn't come up with an alternative solution for the 11th grade end of career math test. So it turns that back on. But then as part of a process trying to work with Representative Mariani and recognizing that I certainly don't want to overstate his support for the bill, because I'm sure he would vote against it because we still do have a cut score, and I know he opposes that. But in an attempt to start building the mechanisms for the future state that the Access Committee worked very hard on and for which we were this close to actually having a bill signed into law in the 2010 legislative session, we have actually built the end of course test components into this bill as well through an amendment by Representative Kiefer in the Ed Policy Bill, or in the Ed Policy Committee. However, one component that was left out of that amendment was the alignment index. So we are, in essence, incorporating the gist of Representative Mariani's bill and the delete all that he had proposed to my bill in the first place, with the exception that we now have a cut score on the end of career 11th grade math test that we currently have, and we would have a cut score on the end of course test as well, as compared to simply including them as part of the student's grade in the course. So the purpose here is to take a stand and say we think our kids and our teachers and our schools are good enough that with a couple of years they can get themselves prepared to do adequately on the 11th grade math test at the end of their career, leaving open flexibility and possibilities that perhaps a different cut score would be established in order to make it a little more plausible. Flexibility and openness on that, and then also positioning us for the future, where I think there was pretty broad consensus that end of course is a better testing mechanism than end of career, especially with so many kids taking the test and literally covering content that they might have had back in eighth grade or ninth grade, some even earlier than that. So I hope this strikes the right balance between putting a stake in the ground and saying, you know what, standards matter. They're there for a reason. Simply punting on the grad requirement for 11th grade math test is, I think, sending the wrong signal and not setting the bar high enough, and I think our kids can get there. But also recognizing that a lot of good work by the Access Committee went into devising a new approach, and we would keep that new approach kind of on the implementation plan here and hopefully get to that and then figure out what to do with the end of course or the end of career assessment at the point that those end of course assessments were put in place. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would stand for questions.
Representative Downey, first let me just ask if there is any public testimony here in favor or in opposition of the bill. Hearing none, we will move to questions. Representative Erickson, I believe you were up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, on page 7, your amendment changes on line 29, the commissioner must to the commissioner may. That's an interesting construction when it comes to the development of additional exams. And are you trying to suggest that this is permissive? Maybe the commissioner will, or maybe she doesn't have to. So you don't want to make it mandatory. You want to give her some option. Is that what you're doing here, some flexibility? Page 7, on your amendment, it's line 117.
Yeah.
But in going to your engrossment on page 7, line 29, delete must and insert may. I've never read a construction like that before, but you must have a reason.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, you raise a good question. And frankly, the original language that is in the bill as it stands came from Representative Kiefer's bill. And the amendment that I'm offering also came from Representative Kiefer, who I was hoping would be here to explain the components of it. I guess if you had significant concerns with that, I would be glad with a friendly amendment, because actually I think I concur with your premise. If it says may and not must, you don't have a bill. Somebody told me that once in a committee. So,
well, Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, I think others maybe want to comment on it because they might interpret it differently from me. I think Representative Breinert's ready.
To that point, Representative Breinert?
Mr. Chair, I would just ask Ms. Larson to comment on the...
Ms. Larson?
I think it's the rest of the clause that changes what the need for a must or a may, because... But,
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Breinert, in my opinion, it has no effect whatsoever.
Yeah, the okay, two terms can be interchangeable, but...
it doesn't matter.
Well, any Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, I was just doing the Phyllis Kahn test. When I first served, she gave me the must-may rule.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay. Other questions from members? Representative Breinert.
Well, first of all, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, I'm going to apologize because I haven't studied this in detail. So when does the end of course process start?
We actually...
Representative Downey, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
A minor issue here.
We had quite some discussion, and the department attempted to clarify, and I'm not sure that anybody came away fully clarified, but my understanding is that they would be in place and in effect by the year 2017. Some question about whether or not the process would start along with the MCA-3 test, and my impression was that it would start in conjunction with that, which I believe that test is due to be online in 2013, so the process in essence could start any time in that window, but it was due to be online by 2017.
Okay. Representative Breinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it seems like we'll have plenty of time to have some of these conversations, but my question would be around the issue whether it's meaningful or to have a cut score in end of course if you have a comprehensive math exam that has a cut score. In other words, do the coexistence of those two processes make it a better move to remove the cut score from the end of course? And I know there's some discussion there, but I would want us to pursue that. But it seems like we have some time to do that.
Sub Downey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brenner, exactly. I guess the idea that you could turn off the cut score on the end of career math test, or perhaps even rethink whether that makes sense, given that you're doing an end of course, high stakes, those would all be decisions that could be made in the future. The point is, let's get the high stakes, the grad requirement turned back on a year earlier as compared to the 5-year window that we had originally given 2 years ago in the legislature.
President Brenner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then because I wasn't in this discussion in reform, I'm wondering what comments the department had about pursuing both of these avenues simultaneously.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair and Representative Breinert, that was actually quite a bit of discussion, and after lots of discussion and quite a bit of testimony from the Department of Education, my takeaway is that the current progression of new tests for MCA3 plus the inclusion of the end of course tests would all be part of kind of their typically appropriated for and planned for test development process, and that we weren't asking them to do anything beyond what they normally would be doing anyway. The standards are established for MCA3. The test development for end of career for MCA3 is already in process. So, you know, creating components that would work for an end of course exam, from what I understood and from what you see in the fiscal note, does not create any additional or undue burden or new process for the Department of Education. But they aren't here to comment on that, so it might be a separate offline discussion for you to confirm what I am pretty sure I understood from many, many minutes, if not hours, of discussion in reform.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one last. I think I have a good perspective on this now. I would just ask that whoever among us continues to be involved in this discussion as it moves forward, that I do think it's a very serious issue to keep a cut score in the end of course while you have a comprehensive math exam. And I think we shouldn't lose sight of that issue. Because a cut score in the end of course does change some of the character of that exam. I'm not trying to take a position on it. I'm just saying I think we need to keep both of those in mind as we move forward.
Representative Downey?
No, Mr. Chair, thank you for those comments, and that there is a bit of a philosophical departure on some for the existence of a cut score period, and then having a cut score end of course plus a cut score on an end of career math test. I agree that warrants a lot of discussion.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I like the bill. I just had a question, Representative Downey, on page 6, beginning with line 32. Are we saying it's okay for an English language student to graduate without being proficient in math or biology?
Representative Downey.
What line is it? Can you repeat?
Representative Anderson, could you repeat the line in?
It's on page 6, line 32 through 34. I think I'm looking at the right copy.
6.32.
Waiving the exam for a high school student who is an English language learner.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Kiefer.
Hi. For the record, I'm Andrea Kiefer. This is recommended from the prior Education Commission Task Force, which included our current Commissioner Brenda Casellas, also Representative Mariani, some people from the Minnesota Department of Education. Mainly, I think that a lot of the math is word problems, and so they were having trouble being able to score a proficient level. And this is just going to allow flexibility. Okay. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I just hope we aren't having two sets of standards and that
right.
those kids get an education as well before they graduate.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, but I think the point is that we don't want to squelch anyone. We want everyone to meet the bar, but there's certain exceptions where it may be really tough for them to meet this certain test, so there'll be alternatives. And I don't know, I'm sorry I'm late, but did we talk about the alternatives, like
no,
AP?
Go ahead.
If you look at the end, there's lots of different alternatives. So if a student's ready to go to college, they're going to have to pass some certain entrance exams anyway. So we've got ACT, SAT, CLEP, IB, advanced placement courses. And then we also just mentioned in 813 alternative methods by which the student satisfies. And this will also take care of students that are maybe transferring in from a different school, mid high school years.
Representative Anderson?
Okay.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel like Dwayne Quam here, massaging. Representative Kiefer, if just to the point Representative Anderson asks about that, and when you talk about the word problems and so forth, in there, I know from personal experience that there's so much in word problems, there's so much that's dependent upon your level of reading, and sometimes your math proficiency gets lost in just trying to read the problem, and a lot of kids don't process that very well, but they can do the math part of it. But I am curious, on page 7 of your bill, under I. It says there, a district or a charter school must indicate on a student's transcript the student's level of college and career readiness in reading, writing. It says algebra and biology at the bottom. And I'm just curious why it says algebra instead of maybe some other math or biology. There's no chemistry component in there. I'm just curious, that's all.
Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. This is a discussion, but again, this is coming from recommendations from a task force. A lot of this language, I don't know if we talked about this in this committee yet, but a lot of this language is from House File 44 from this year. It's also from last year's House File 3421, I think. But I'll try to find it and correct myself if I'm wrong. We're looking at end-of-course exams, first of all, so it won't be a one-time this, you know, do it now or forget it. And according to our committee meeting a couple days ago, the department is gearing up for that. They're prepared to change into end-of-course exams. And the business community felt that biology was an important science to add. You know, we're talking about STEM. We're talking about increasing our proficiency and helping our students know more about the science and math. And so they... biology is new. We didn't have the science component of it in the past. And I guess the business community kind of picked biology as the science of choice.
Thank you.
Again, I think there'd be some flexibility.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, if I could add a couple of things. We had actually some really interesting testimony in education policy in my first term about the science curriculum in Minnesota, and that it was a little highly oriented towards earth sciences as compared to hard sciences, which tend to be the sciences that employers are looking for. And so I think this is recognition that a move away from maybe the natural sciences to something a little harder, but maybe not quite as hard as physics or chemistry was where they were coming from. And then if I could also just make one comment in response to Representative Anderson's question. The actual paragraph starts by saying, allow an eligible student to meet this exam requirement through an alternative method. So I want to make sure people don't get the impression that, gee, you can't speak English, so you don't have to pass the test. You still have to substantiate your proficiency. And then also, it would waive the requirement for a high school student who is an English language learner but hasn't been enrolled or has been enrolled for less than 4 years. So we're really talking about somebody who probably has come over or come in with you know, limited English skills, pretty recent time frame. So we're not attempting to give a free pass to people just because they can't read the test questions. Well, there's some criteria there.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did participate on this committee for most of the 6 months that it met, so I have some insight into both of those discussions. The English language learner requirement, Representative Anderson, specifically relates to the clear awareness that it takes 6 to 7 years for a non-English speaker to be proficient, so to expect them to pass a test at the level of a high school end of course that has consequences for graduation or for, too high stakes for the skill, for the risk of that they might not have the language skills. And there were most of the professionals at the table felt that it was not appropriate that they should have that option of a waiver. The algebra and biology, I mean, algebra is the new graduation requirement. I mean, we're requiring our students to have algebra 2 by the end of their high school, so that's why algebra rather than any other math. And I know that you were the hard science issue. I'll just take a little part. And the reason I do is I have a daughter who is a geologist in geophysics, and she would make physicist, and she'd make the argument that that's as hard of a science as chemistry or any other in terms of its research demands and so forth. But biology is the science that most schools require for graduation. There was discussion whether there should also be a chemistry option, and the discussion is that may come in the future, but start with biology.
So. Representative Kiefer or Downey, did you have a comment, or you want to go to the next question?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to thank Representative Reinert, sorry. And I also wanted, just for the record, I mentioned a House file, so I wanted to make sure I got the number right. It was from 2010. It was House File 3421. That a lot of the language is from.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to our testifiers. And I apologize for coming in late. And if you've covered this ground, just wave me off and I can talk to you offline. But, and I know, Representative Downey, you and I have talked about this. And I think you're addressing some of my concerns with regards to the Assessment Advisory Committee and other ways to show proficiency if you don't pass the test. I've had this situation with my own child, and a number of parents have expressed concern to me. Very good, very high-achieving students who did well on their ACTs, have done, you know, straight-A kids, a lot of them taking AP classes, and they fail this test. And I'm trying to figure out what's going on. So I think this is a good way to look at that. There's a number of measures. The other question I have, though, is, and I haven't had a chance to read every line of the bill, are we looking at the test itself and what we're measuring? Because I understand that there's a lot of questions on there that aren't necessarily related to the coursework or other things. And is there some look at maybe narrowing to what it is we really want to know, that kids know these things, as opposed to testing other proficiencies?
Representative Downey or Kiefer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loon, and you were part of the discussions as part of the K-12 Policy Committee last time. So again, I don't want to speak for the department, and if somebody has shown up who can speak for this better than I am, I'm glad to hear it. But the MCA 2 test, even as it exists today, covers more than the grad requirement. And so the student takes the MCA 2 test, and then my understanding is that they lift out, if you will, the grad requirement components and determine whether they met the graduation requirement or not. And that would continue to be the case. With MCA 3, you're actually increasing even more the total content and knowledge base that's being examined in that test. And so the graduation requirements would be lifted out of that. I would assume, and again, I don't want to speak for the testers, but you'd probably have something similar in the end of course exams as well, if we had a cut score or a grad requirement in there. So those tests are designed to be the full MCA test, but then to lift out the components that are necessary for graduation.
Representative Loon?
Okay. Well, and maybe I should speak to the department more about this, but that's just something I have a little concern about that. It's my understanding that test is actually quite long when you take it. And when my daughter did the retake took a lot less time. It was very short. So I'm wondering how much of that is just kind of seeing what our kids know. And that does have an effect on children as they're taking a test, the whole test fatigue issue and that. And again, I have a little question about the relevancy. But thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been on a few of the committees for the math MCA 2, and the attempt is to try and have, besides the covering what you need for graduation, to try and have an idea of the broader capabilities and scope of knowledge. And so test questions are sampled and with groups of students, the results and how well the students do on the questions, and a little bit of analysis on the appropriateness of the questions is done. So there's quite a bit that goes into it, and the committees that pick which questions are included are primarily teachers, but also include people from the community, from school boards, and from administration. So there's an attempt to try and have a little bit broader than just testing to maybe a narrow aspect. I agree that the length and test fatigue is an issue, and I really think that the newer test technology would be a way to go, of where you take answer a question on the computer, and depending if you get that right or wrong, it directs you to a question, and it really better understands in a shorter period of time the capabilities of the student, but still covers what's needed to in the testing. So I would hope that going forward they could improve the test, because, you know, honestly, after about 20 to 40 minutes, a student's results on the test are not so much knowledge-based as it's been alluded to, fatigue of taking the test. And for most students, I don't think you do any justice if you give them more than about a, you know, 25 or 30 minute test. Thank you.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of items. I very much appreciate the concerns Representative Loon has raised. I mean, I've been on this and similar committees for several years and around in this discussion. And I guess there's we have successfully, bipartisanly identified there's something with this test. I'm not convinced that we've answered the question of what that is, however. Is it misaligned with the curriculum and the standards currently? If it is, that's not a kid problem. That's a grown-up problem. Is it simply too hard? Is the test misaligned to the standards as opposed to misaligned to the curriculum? That would certainly explain the high failure rate. If that's the case, again, that's a grown-up problem, not a kid problem, and we might want to work on fixing that. And I'm wondering if, rather than reinstating this requirement, if it wouldn't be wiser to step back and review the test and make sure that the test is appropriate before we require kids to go at it. Two other quick things. One, while the metaphor broken record is lost on young people today, because they don't understand, but vinyl is making a comeback. I'm going to be a broken record here. You're still missing College in the Schools under the advisory task force or the advisory committee, and I'd remind you that with College in the Schools, it successful passage there doesn't tell you if a child is ready for college. It tells you they're doing college-level work, which I think is a step higher than they're ready for college. And then I just would caution, this is the sort of thing, and I'll let my teacher colleagues around the table disagree with me if they wish, but this is the sort of move that breeds cynicism amongst teachers. I know, gasp. Here are the rules of the road. Oh, now we're changing the rules of the road. Oh, now we're going to do it again. And it doesn't take more than a couple years in teaching to go, okay, I'll ignore the legislature. Because you just get so cynical. And it's not the best side of our profession, but it is learned. It's not made up. So I just counsel some caution there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
So I just counsel some caution there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Kiefer, Downey, did you wish to respond or not? No?
Mr. Chair, I'll respond. I know we talked about the PSEO options, concurrent enrollment, and we are totally open to adding that in. I do believe it is addressed a little bit when we say advisory committee must develop recommendations for alternative methods by which the students satisfy. So I think that's in there, that language is allowing the flexibility, but we can certainly put more specific things in there if you'd like. And I agree with you on what are we measuring. And if there's grade inflation, the students should not be punished. That is a problem that the school has. And that is exactly why I really wanted this amendment passed today, because I think this will show if there's some misalignment in grade inflation.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of thoughts. One is Representative Loon left, but the issue around the MCAs is we need to remember they're first a systems check. So it's checking the as how the curriculum aligns to the standards, it may not be the best individual test for proficiency for the student, and that's, they're trying to do two things at once. There's a lot of question about whether they can do two things at once effectively. But to Representative Davney's point, I would be interested in either or both of your reflections on the fact that I understand why you're moving the exemption, or the what is the right term I'm trying to think of? Yes, the exemption, right up 1 year, you know, that because there's certainly been some dissatisfaction from a lot of fronts with the take the two tests and have no consequences sort of approach. However, we're doing that, and at the same time, you are actually instating what was seen to be the remedy for, I mean, the exemption was put in, which was end of course. You're actually putting the end of course in place and keeping, you know, the MCA 2 or 3, you know, with the graduation consequence. So I think there's some room for reflection there about whether do we need or want both of those parallel systems. And I know you said the department said they were capable of doing that and it might be in line of, with what's appropriate, but my concern would be more in the grassroots level for teachers, what it's going to mean in the classrooms and in the schools as we roll out both of these systems and how they'll be correlated. And I think we might at some point want to hear from our math teachers around the state on that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Briner, you raise a good point. And again, it's hard to totally interpret everything the department has said, and I know we have someone here, so perhaps we can get a little more clarity. My understanding originally was that it would be quite a few years after 2013 before the end of course tests would be ready to come online in a way that they could be the end of course exam that we contemplate here with a cut score. And so my thought was, wow, to Representative Dabney's point, we did stop. We've stopped for 2 years. And we'll stop for another 2 years, even under my bill. But it's that as compared to stopping for another 3 years. So it seems to me that's we're sending a stronger signal, and that's really important to me and the reason for my bill. You know, if in fact in the end the department can come online with end of course tests that, you know, meet everything that we're looking for, and that can be done by the year 2013, I don't know why we would continue having an end of career graduation requirement test if in fact the mechanisms for the end of course are all in place and everybody agrees with that. My sense originally going into preparing this bill was that there could be quite a few years lead time before that would occur, so then we'd have a gap of literally, I guess from end to end it would have been 7 years where we weren't imposing or expecting a graduation requirement. Yeah.
Representative Briner, do you have a follow-up? Are there any other questions for members of the committee? Any closing comments, Representative Kiefer or Downey?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Grant.
Aren't we going to hear from the department? I would like to hear what they have to say now that they're here.
Is the department here? Oh, okay. Come on down. My apologies. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Jennifer Dugan, Minnesota Department of Education Research and Assessment. Speaking to, apologies for my tardiness, and I didn't hear the entire conversation. I think I'll talk a little bit about alignment of the content of the test, if that would help. The current MCAs are aligned to the, in grade 11, are aligned to the entire depth and breadth of the grade 11 academic standards. The grad is a subset of that MCA 2. So 25 of the 40 questions overlap the content from the MCAs. The other 15 questions that count for the grad score come from the 8th grade benchmarks, from the 8th grade academic standards in Minnesota. So to give you an idea of that context, in contrast from the BST, if we're talking just math, many of the BST items were realigned actually to the 2003 academic standards into grade 5. To give you a comparison of difficulty and expectation of the students. So BST to grad to now we are expecting students to the purpose of the when the College and Career Readiness Policy Institute met last year, the focus of that was to say that they discussed a lot what do we want to call a high school diploma to indicate in Minnesota, and you're seeing that reflected in this language of indicating college and career ready. And so that is why they bumped the reading and the writing into grade 10, and then a high school algebra end of course assessment, which with the 2007 math standards equates to roughly when we were in school algebra 2. So to give again that content extreme, there are measurement ways that we can give an end of course exam and set different cuts to indicate different things. So one of the options would be we could set a college and career readiness indicator, but that would not necessarily be what the student would need to achieve in order to earn a high school diploma. So there are ways that you can have the assessment and have it indicate different things on the college diploma, or on the high school diploma, sorry.
Are there any other questions? Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I didn't catch your name.
Jennifer Dugan.
Dugan. Okay, Ms. Dugan. So could you critique this legislation for us based on what the department is doing and the direction that the commissioner wants to go?
Ms. Dugan.
Thank you. The high school reading and writing work is just beginning, because we adopted, as I spoke to on Tuesday, we just adopted new language arts standards in 2010. And so that development is preliminary, but we recognize the need to have a writing test that indicates college and career readiness and have a high school reading test that indicates college and career readiness. And so that work is more in the preliminary stages. The math work is a little bit farther ahead, just because of the revision of the standards. They were revised in 2007, and so we've been doing some development to get to the point of implementing an MCA 3 in grade 11 aligned to those 2007 standards, and that by current statute would be operational in the spring of 14. So we've been doing some of that development already. Many of those benchmarks, we really focused last year on the Algebra 2 effort, and so development effort. And so now this year we focus not only on the algebra development, but also geometry and data. So we are moving in that direction to have an assessment aligned to the 2007 standards as required by statute.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Dugan, apologies if you've already covered this. I wasn't able to be at the hearing Tuesday night, so I didn't hear what you had to say there. So is there any position on this legislation by the department? Commissioner? That's, I guess, what I really want to know.
You know, that's got to be the best look I've seen so far in this session. That was...
I just make pests.
Unfortunately, I don't make the test. Brian Shackleton, Department of Education.
Mr. Shackleton, can you bring her to committee more often?
You request and we we work it out. We do not have a position on this bill at this point.
Representative Greiling.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Well, then, Mr. Shackleton, I would like to find out what it is and have some conversations about that, because I know, you know, I wasn't at the hearing before, and I have never personally delved into this as much as Representative Reinert and Representative Mariani, and now Representative Downey and Representative Kiefer. Yeah, I didn't serve on that task force, but I have been around the block enough to know that end-of-course exams can be controversial, and that cut scores, however they're used and for whatever they're used and if they're different or not, can be very controversial. I myself wasn't comfortable with the cut scores last year that came out of the task force, and so when this bill got through the committee that I chaired, we changed it, and of course we didn't get the bill passed, so much for that. But I know that as the Board of Teaching was working on the cut scores last year, just setting them by rule, that was controversial, and there was some opposition to what was going on there, and then the question, should they be even set in rule, and shouldn't it be, should it be done over here, or how should it be done, is the controversy. So I just want more direction on this. For me, not being an expert in the area, I wish Representative Mariani were here as well, but I understood he had some concerns about the bill. I'm not quite clear on what they are, but I will say my position on this bill is unformed as well.
Any additional questions for our testifiers? Representative Erickson.
Hold on.
I did not see a second column. There's already one here. So it's Representative Loon. What does that say? Reinhardt? That's not even close, Aaron. What are you talking about?
That was a
little messy. We'll go with Loon, Reinhardt, and then Erickson. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Aaron has handwriting like mine, maybe. Thank you for your testimony. And just a question for you, I think, Ms. Dugan. You mentioned on the test having a possibility, I think, of a college and career-ready cut score and then a grad cut score. And I'm wondering how that college and career-ready cut score in your mind would square with like an ACT or an SAT, which most kids are going to take if they're planning to go to college anyway.
There are several ways to set the cut. So one of the ways that we discussed during the CCRPI committee and other ways that have been done across the country is actually to do research with common person and longitudinal data to do exactly as you are suggesting, to make sure that we're being consistent with other indicators and we're not contradicting that. And so that was part of I know where it is on my copy, and it's not the one I put it up.
Maybe
the one that says that the students can, for 2 years, the committee can look at other options. They can graduate under the grad, or they can graduate. Right. Here. Here it is. 6.36. So, and then continue on to the next page. So it gives the commissioner the option and the committee the option of looking at granting a little bit of leeway to those students caught in the transition while we're collecting that data and verifying that it is indicating what we intend to indicate.
Okay. Thank you. So, Mr. Chair and Ms. Dugan, so then to take from that, it would be the intention to look at having some relationship between, if we're going to have a college career readiness cut score and perhaps what a student would score in the math section on the ACT or something like that. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Breiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dugan, I don't know if you can answer this question for me. I know that Mr. Shackleton cannot, so we'll see what, not just because it relates to the difficulty we had when we instituted this moratorium on the passing requirement and what was going on there with the setting of the cut score and the number of students we saw failing. Mm-hmm. So now we're moving back into requiring passage. Is the cut score going to be the same? Are we going to change the cut score? And if the cut score is going to be the same, what have we done in the meantime in terms of a better alignment of our curriculum with our standards? Do you see my dilemma? I mean, we did this because it was very clear that the system was failing the students, not that the students were failing to be prepared. So I'm asking you, have we done something to address that?
Ms. Dugan.
Thank you. There is not the intent to reset the cut or the number of the equivalent number of questions that students would need to get correct. I do believe there have been, especially now that we have now actually transitioned into another, we've leapfrogged into another set of standards. So not only have the high school teachers had the opportunity to implement the 2003 standards, but now they've had the chance to go even further and have more rigorous standards aligned to the and align their curriculum to the 2007 standards. I do believe that due to the shift in rigor of Algebra 1 for all 8th graders in the state of Minnesota, I think we will start seeing a dramatic shift in preparation for high school, and not just doing the, it is my sincere hope that we're not just doing the same thing. I know that our academic standards folks have done a lot to promote, and the math academies have done a lot to promote different ways to approach math, especially to students that typically struggle, and so not teaching math the same way that probably we all learned it, where the teacher stood at the front of the board and worked the problem, and then we went home and worked 30 homework problems and turned in our homework, and then she showed us how to do more problems the next day.
Representative Breiner.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Dugan, in the test-making business, how then will you take into account in when you move into the MC3s the lessons of the MC2s in terms of the setting the cut scores in relation to the standards and curriculum shaping process?
Thank you. We're actually doing that to an extent this year, and when we set the standards for 3-8 MCA3s, we intend to bring in some outside data that we have not previously to make sure that the standards are the cut standards, the achievement levels are consistent with NAEP and TIMSS and all of those other reports that we continually are compared against. And so for grades 3-8, that's our intent this year to the extent possible. And then we would absolutely intend to do that, plus the other pieces of the ACT, SAT, et cetera, when we get to the high school part of setting the standards for the MCA3s.
Representative Brandon.
Okay, so thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just end quickly. So we would expect not necessarily better results, although I would think we would see better results. We would expect more understanding on the part of our math, our staff, about what the correlation is between the results and the curriculum, that we, because we didn't have that with the MCA2s. Would you agree with that?
That would be the hope. Absolutely. That would be the intent.
Any other questions, Representative Breiner? Representative Breiner, do you have any other questions? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dugan, I think I have a simple question. How many items are on the test that our juniors are taking for the math, the MC2s? And then I think I heard you say that of these, I think you said 40 items. Of those 40, 15 of them count toward the grad, and they're based on the 8th grade benchmarks. Would you go over that again? I think that's what I heard, but I need to have it again.
Absolutely. So, I'm sorry, I'm a hand waver. So, here's the entire test that 11th graders take, and that includes questions that actually are counting for a host of things. Some of them don't count for their score. They're used to create future assessments. So those are the field test questions. And then there are 15 that only count for their grad score. That's all that they count. And then there's 25 that count for their grad score, and the same 25 also contribute to their MCA score. So they only have to take one question, but it contributes to both scores. And then there's, we just changed because of the elimination of the constructed response. I knew it before we eliminated the constructed response.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's around 30 that just count for the MCA score.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
And Ms. Dugan, when a student retakes the grad, because I was listening to Representative Moon, is it those 15 questions only? Is that why she said it seemed that when retaking it,
It went a lot faster.
Is that, am I correct in that?
It's only the 40. So it's the 15 and the 25.
Oh, okay, the 15 and the 25. Okay.
And it's only multiple choice.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Dugan or the testifiers? Representative Dietrich. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Dugan, and maybe Representative Downey needs to answer this. So this discussion has just spurred some memories of education policy. So the kids who are in, who are required to take Algebra 1 by 8th grade, when will they, what year will they be in 11th grade?
Well, my Minnesota math tells me 3 years, Representative Dietrich.
No. Then I'm asking this wrong.
Yeah. Ms. Dugan, is 11 minus 8 3?
No. Because these kids, it was the 6th graders like 3 years ago that were going to be held to the Algebra 1 standard in 8th grade. And then they get it.
Ms. Dugan, you want to answer the question? I don't understand.
They're in 8th grade this year, so yes. They will be 11th graders as a cohort in 2013-14, and then they would graduate in 14-15. And that is why the assessment is scheduled to be realigned to the new standards in 13-14.
That was going to be my question.
They would be in 11th grade in 3 years, then.
No, we did not know they were in 8th grade when we asked the question. Okay. We didn't know where they were, in between 6th grade and 11th grade.
Representative Dietrich.
So you're putting
a smile on my face. Thank you.
So, Representative Downey, this is the impetus for choosing that date, that year, because those kids will now be taking the 11th grade test.
Representative Downey or Ms. Dugan?
Mr. Chair, I'll give I think part of what you're looking for in terms of an answer. So my intent is that we did take a break, and I sure hope that if there were, you know, curriculum alignment issues, we keep blaming the system here. I'm not sure I totally buy that based on all of the information and testimony that I heard 2 years ago. But in either case, they've had 2 years. They will have another 2 years, even under my bill, to get ready. So that was the purpose for me pulling that a year forward into 2013. I'll allow Ms. Dugan to clarify this, but the transition from the MCA 2 to MCA 3, I'm assuming that the grad subset is still testing the same content or intending to measure the same graduation requirement, irrespective of the fact that now these additional MCA 3 questions will be in the test. We're still lifting out the same competencies in the grad standard, unless she informs me that the grad standard actually changes along with that. But oh,
Ms. Dugan?
We will do as you desire. Since
now
we
that's
have not
a great
constructed
answer.
The test. The intent would be that as long as the grad exists, if that is the, if you want that indicator to be consistent, then we would lose that overlap of content, so they'd have to take more questions on the test, but the actual grad score could continue to be embedded to improve motivation, etc., if that was the desire of the committee.
Representative Dietrich, did you have a follow-up?
So, Ms. Dugan, so does the current grad math test that doesn't have high stakes, does that include Algebra 1 concepts?
Ms. Dugan?
It does.
Okay.
It includes, and that's a very difficult question to answer depending upon your curriculum. I would say it has some questions that you might find at the very beginning of an Algebra 2 book. So someone may say there's Algebra 2 in there as well. The geometry is certainly a geometry course. So, for example, there are trig functions yes. that are included on that grad portion.
Representative
Dietrich. So, as I guess the question I'm wondering is, are there 11th graders now, or this has been going on now for what, 4 or 5 years? This math test, were there kids taking it then who had not completed Algebra 1?
That Algebra 1, let's see. Well, their curriculum should be aligned to the academic standards, and all students are required, and I don't know the year off the top of my head, but all students are required to complete Algebra 2 by the time they graduate. So it is possible, depending upon their schedule, they could be enrolled in Algebra 1 and geometry the year they took the 11th grade test, and they were going to finish Algebra 2 their senior year. So it's very difficult to say, because we don't have a universal curriculum.
Representative Dietrich. Any other questions for members of the committee? Any closing comments, Representative Kiefer, Downey, or Ms. Dugan?
No, Mr. Chair.
With that, Representative Downey renews his motion to have House File 558, as amended, laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Downey. And Ms. Dugan, thank you for coming over and testifying. We do appreciate it. Members, that completes our agenda for the day. Are there any questions, comments, or for the chair? Mm-hmm. Representative Gratling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any further word?
No, I think we're on schedule for Wade discussed earlier.
Is it? Okay, thank you.
Okay. Anything else, members? With that, we are adjourned. Thank you.